Fright Rags is celebrating the 30th anniversary of Tim Burton's classic Edward Scissorhands with an all-new collection. Available now, get Edward Scissorhands apparel featuring shirts, socks, and an enamel pin. Also, keep your eyes peeled for Fright Rags' second Vestron collection featuring shirts from Waxwork, Blood Diner, and my personal favorite, The Wishmaster. You'll find these available Friday, January 24th. Shop now at fright-rags.com. Again, for shirts from Waxwork, Blood Diner, and Wishmaster, Shockwaves listeners get 10% off their first order using Shock2020 at checkout. Again, 10% off when you check out at fright-rags.com. Use the code Shock2020.
This week's episode of Shockwaves is sponsored by RLJE Films. Richard Stanley returns as the director of Color Out of Space, starring Nicolas Cage. See it on the big screen today. Head to colorout of space.com and find a theater near you.
From visionary director Osgood Perkins and an executive producer of The Insidious comes Gretel and Hansel. Forget the fairy tale that you know and witness a dark and twisted adaptation of the beloved story. Sophia Lillis of It stars in Gretel and Hansel in theaters nationwide on January 31st. Very excited for Osgood's new movie. Visit GretelandHanselTheMovie.com for more info.
It's 2020 and Fangoria magazine is back on shelves, and Fangoria.com is on a mission to bring you even more horror content than ever before. It's a great new decade to be a horror fan. Fangoria.com is your destination for all the horror news of the day, featuring a constant curation of the Fango editorial team's favorite links from across the internet. You'll also find deep dives and daily thoughts from the biggest names in horror, as well as exclusive access to the Fangoria Vault, which we've been into and it was highly impressive. Become a Fangoria Plus member and receive your coffee table-worthy issue of the magazine, full digital access to Fangoria.com, invitations to special events and screenings, and much, much more. Go to Fangoria.com and become a member today. Use promo code Shockwaves for 15% off right now. Welcome back to Shockwaves, episode 174. I am your host, Elric Kane, and joining me, as always, as I always intro, to my left, the man, Ryan Turek. There's another man, too, but hi.
Hi. I'm Ryan Turek.
Hi, Ryan Turek.
I just noticed that Ryan has little pouches on his jacket.
I'm ready for action.
The person pointing out his fashion faux pas to his left, Rebecca Cackling McKendry.
Yes, yes.
You fit one in there.
You like that?
I liked it.
I got it on Twitter this week where somebody was like, the laugh, and I was like, yeah, and they were like, it's a cackle.
You self-named it a cackle. Yeah. I didn't do that. And completing the vicious circle, you guys will never let me do this again, is Rob G.
Hello.
Are you still good with just being called Rob G?
Or, sure. Okay. I'm fine with it.
If this is your first time listening, we are Shockwaves.
Our intros are usually...
very smooth, whenever Rob meets them. Also, our sound engineer is Mr. Ernie Hurtado. And he is the best.
Becca, would you like me to put your pen in my pocket that's on my arm?
Is that what that's for?
Do you have a protractor in there?
Shut up.
It looks like utility pants.
I was
like,
told walking out of the store that this shirt was decent.
No, this shirt is very cool. It looks in the 90s back, you know, when I used to do like Club Kids, I would go to Gadzooks and I would buy these like ginormous JNCO pants that had like zippers going all the way down.
Rob, save us from a fashion podcast.
This is very fascinating for a horror podcast. Yeah, yeah. Let's dive right in.
What horror stuff do you guys all do this weekend?
Well, we had a group movie.
We did have a group movie. I'm a little concerned, though.
Why are you concerned?
I am very concerned because this is actually one of my favorite films of the 90s, and I saw Becca's rating, and it horrified me.
You know, Elric, you had mentioned to me before that this is one of your favorite films of the 90s, and I just want to say, you know, a lot of films came out in the 90s. I mean, Starship Troopers came out in the 90s. That's a good
film, right?
This one's better than those films.
I'm backing Elric 100%
yeah,
if that's
I don't
case.
Think you saw the movie. I'm so quizzed.
Oh, my God.
We're going to give her a quiz to make sure she actually watched it. So the movie was Body Parts, which Scream Factory was celebrating because Scream Factory is putting out a brand new Blu-ray of it. First time on Blu-ray.
Yep.
At the end of the month, January 28th, we got an early sneak peek at the disc. It is on digital, so you can rent it right now if you can't wait.
And it's a pretty accessible movie. I mean, Body Parts is not one of those movies that came out in the theaters, went to VHS, and then, you know, it was always readily accessible.
I saw this on DVD so much.
Huh?
Not so much on DVD in the
long
run. It
was on DVD.
Not in the last few years, though,
I don't think. On DVD. I think it came out at, like, the beginning of DVD.
But you could find it on streaming and so on. But Scream Factory gave it its proper due.
Yeah.
You know? Oh, and yeah.
So I went to see this movie in the theater in high school on a date.
Oh,
I was.
That's probably was your
date. Was your date's
name?
Date.
Well, I was gonna say, was your date's name Jeffrey Dahmer?
And that's why she gave this
such
a low rating.
Jeff Fahey. No,
clearly a flaccid date.
This
given
one, and you know, it's the same response that I had in the '90s, where I am in for the tissue transference of memory. And as soon as the dude that we just killed and dismembered shows back up, it loses me.
No, but that's brain science.
All right, well, let's go back to what this movie's about, because people are probably baffled.
Well, who it's by, and this is the fun part. This is the thing that they don't spend a lot of time on the extras, but besides the director, but which is funny because I know how Becca feels about my other favorite movie. This is actually from the source material of the person who did the original story for Vertigo and Diabolik.
Oh, really?
Two French writers. It was called Choice Cuts, the book. Thomas Boileau and Pierre Naharac, I think. So that's where the story came from. Hitchcock, funnily enough, had missed out on making Diabolik, and that's why he made
Psycho.
He also missed out on getting this one. So he tried to get the rights for this back then. Also,
you imagine this is a Hitchcock
movie? I thought that was
you
know, and I obviously it has some similarities to things like Eyes Without a Face and things like that. But this one.
And
look,
also, I was going to say the Peter Lorre film, Mad Love.
Mad Love's a great film, too, So this is by Eric Red. So Eric Red, who obviously met Catherine Bigelow when he was at AFI together, they made. Or is it USA? I can't remember which one. They made, you know, a couple great films together. He also wrote The Hitcher. So it has the similar energy to that.
Yeah,
but
Near
this
Dark
is,
was the big one with him.
Yeah.
And he co-wrote this with Norman Snyder, and who did Dead Ringers.
Yeah. The extras are really good on this.
Yeah,
one other thing is he actually really wrote the script solo, but then basically they went into production and were moving so fast.
Yeah.
All rewrites, he needed somebody to be in there. It sounds like Franco Mancuso Jr. was a total superhero on this and gave him everything he wanted.
I mean, like, he had, you know, he had Snyder on the Dead Ringer side, and then to kind of beef up the action, he apparently brought in Larry Gross, who did 48 Hours or wrote 48 Hours.
Yeah. But it's like, you know, sometimes when we watch these things, it's like, oh, I really wanted to do this, but I couldn't get it. And this was really refreshing because it was like, no, everything I wanted to do, you know, we got to pull off, except there's some scenes that got cut.
Well, Rob, take us through the story.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, so Jeff Fahey is is he a teacher at a
He's a criminal psychology professor.
Guys, don't you remember my story? This is why I did a degree in criminal psychology.
You wanted to follow in
the
Jeff Fahey.
The trailer of this movie is why I did a degree. Not even the movie, the trailer when I was a kid.
You did a degree in criminal psychology because
of the trailer.
Jeff Fahey was.
I thought he was so cool. He had a turtleneck.
Criminal psychologist professor.
That is all true.
This was him at peak Fahey. He's pretty darn cool. So anyway, so he, you know, between teaching a course, he's also interviewing a killer on death row. And very early in the film, he is on the road and sees a car with a wobbly tire.
Perfect final destination.
That scene's great.
It's really great. Basically, you can feel the danger all around him. And basically, he tries to
stop it, but he stays on the phone. He's talking into his tape recorder, leaving notes for his secretary or whomever assists him. Doing so, he's kind of getting distracted by watching this wobbly tire. Generally, that means you, as the driver, ease off the pedal and put some distance between yourself and the potential danger. But Jeff Fahey is engrossed in work. He wants to try to cure the psychotics out there. Uh-huh. And he remains determined to keep moving forward until The worst accident that could ever fucking happen.
But it's not actually the tire that does it. The tire goes off, and then he's like, oh, shit, I narrowly avoided the tire. But then he slams on the brake, and then it causes a
giant,
chain reaction.
A giant truck comes up behind.
Behind him.
And so in the version we've all seen, you know, he gets thrown from the car. It's a brutal pileup.
It's actually one of the greatest
it's pretty
car crash stunts I've ever seen. Like, being reminded of it now, I was like, holy shit.
So, yeah, that scene, I was like, oh, fuck, I didn't remember it being this good, because he literally like flips over the wreckage of the car.
there is a
body that flips
and
through
the best
the air.
News is every scene that comes after this is as good as this scene. And I mean this. No, so here's the best thing about this Blu-ray. Seriously, the best thing about this Blu-ray is, for me, for somebody who's just always loved this film, there's two scenes that were cut, and one of them particularly, he said, was really hard for him because it really mattered to the story. And in the extra shot, it shows you he sees his arm severed from his body. He looks over at it, and they're like, oh, because, you know, why couldn't they resurgically attach it? And he's watching it as a giant truck runs it over. And he said that scene, when they put it in the cut, played gangbusters to test audiences. And so he was fighting for it. They said, no, let's test it without. It scored way less without it, and they still went without it. They just and so he's like, that was the one thing I hated. And there's another one of the surgery later. He said it didn't seem as essential, but to see these scenes in perfect like condition was pretty cool.
Wow.
Really. And it's also like animatronic, so it's moving.
And this is just the beginning.
This is just the beginning.
And I do have to say, we'll continue with the plot where the after he has this car crash, he gets a experimental procedure done where they attach a limb from someone who has recently died onto his body.
And the doctor who does it, this is one of my other things I love about this movie that I didn't remember years ago, is the what's her name? Blue, whatever the hell her name is from The Reflecting Skin, the woman from the right, who is perfect because she looks like kind of like an alien, like Tilda Swinton effect. And so she's in it. And he talks about he wanted to do a female Frankenstein. That was his goal, was to have a story, because he hated that the woman never got to be the mad scientist.
And
type,
she does feel like a female Frankenstein. Yeah, she's really so he gets an arm, and then all of a sudden he starts having these like weird flashes and weird dreams and waking up in sweats. And then like he
And they're surrounded by shotguns when he gets the surgery, so he knows something's not right.
Well, when he sees
the person he's getting it
it's
from.
Through this kind of like feverish dream vision of, you know, he's under obviously a lot of medication and a lot of painkillers. Mm-hmm. But I just love that a lot of that, from the moment he goes into surgery to the time he comes out, there's this kind of like haze, like the hazy framing around it, that really, really works. But it's if you look at the details, yes, the guys are all holding a shotgun, but he kind of looks at them quizzically like, oh, that's really unusual.
Well, any surgery that opens with the taking off of the head of the other person, and that's like a pretty intense moment. Everyone looks at each other and nods, and the guy's head's removed and taken out. You're like, fuck. Like, what's happening with this arm? But, I mean, how far to go into the story? I think you go as far as, like, he gets a body part.
He gets a body part. Brad Dourif gets a body part. And Brad Dourif is my favorite part of the movie, including when Brad Dourif body part gets taken back.
Well, what we should explain is that Jeff Fahey starts to kind of get like unusual visions and it prompts him to go and
reactions. The arm isn't always reacting.
So this prompts him to take a little bit of action and do a little bit of investigating. He goes to see a friend in the police force and he does a fingerprint check.
Yeah,
oh, that's right.
And he discovers that his arm is from this total psychopath who was wanted for murder, killed multiple people, robbed multiple banks. You know, like if you were looking at like the rap sheet, it just goes on and
it's
on
like
and on.
RoboCop, it's just like RoboCop. Yeah. It starts listing every horrible thing. Yeah.
And on top of that, he goes in one of his patients that he is that he's trying to treat. They set it up at the very beginning. I forget what happens, but he holds out his hand and the patient looks at his wrist, and on his wrist he's got a prison tattoo, which you only get if you kill a mofo in prison.
You're on death row.
You're on death row, and he's like, what the fuck, man, who are you, what kind of doctor are you? So that obviously all of Jeff Fahey's suspicions have been manifested, and he's like, oh my God, there's something wrong with my arm, which sends him on a investigation to discover where other body parts from this criminal went, and it leads him to Brad Dourif, who is this artist who is a pretty shitty artist until he got this new arm.
Hey, and then he had landscapes.
He had landscapes. Yeah,
fills walls and hotel rooms, man.
Yeah. And now he's struck with inspiration. Yeah. These nightmarish canvases of dark,
gritty, and
brooding characters and weird shit. And then it goes into crazy, insane territory.
There's a guy who gets his legs. That's one of my favorite. Like, as a kid, I remember that scene so well because the guy gets his new legs first time playing basketball, dunks, and everyone's like, whoa.
Yeah,
and
I was
like,
amazing.
And all that's going through my mind is, could the serial killer dunk? Because I don't think he could. Why is everything hyper good?
It needs a brain, man. Yeah, the brain to operate those legs.
But it really then has to me, like, I guess the part that lost Rebecca to me is like, it has one of the greatest scenes in the history of movies. Ever, like, the and it's how Eric Ritz sold the movie, which was like, and I don't even really want to say, but you know, somebody who wants to get his parts back, and you have a scene in a car that is one of the great.
The car was one of the best scenes. Okay, are we ranking this on like a purely kind of campy factor?
No. Holy shit! That's
okay,
amazing.
No. As soon as the car pulls up, and he kind of. I was because he's got the neck brace on, and then I was just
man, she's killing people with no
head.
That
to me is the most amazing visual.
It is.
Oh my god!
That visual was hard. That visual was. I remember seeing. I think it was like Fangoria. They put that dude on the cover.
Yeah.
You know, he's got like that neck brace. I was like, this is the strangest movie villain I've ever seen.
Yeah.
I always look at this movie as like a Tales from the Crypt episode.
That's what it is.
Yeah. It's very much like a live action Tales from, not live action, a feature length Tales from the Crypt episode. It's just, and it's unique. It's like one of those 90s entries that just has a very unique perspective and a really fun story. And it's just, it keeps twisting and turning and twisting and turning.
I mean, what I love about it, watching it this time, it's a lean 88 minutes.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
This movie moves.
Yeah.
From the
yeah.
moment it starts, you're like yep. in. And yep. you're like, okay, all right, great.
The last few minutes might be a little abrupt. Like the very end, when the comfort, that's the only part where I felt watching this time, I could have used like 5 more minutes here.
Yeah.
But yeah, I agree with you. It moves. And it's serious. He writes with a lot of emotion. It's very dark. All his films, right, have been very dark. But he has a lot of emotion. This guy's a real family.
I mean, like the first 5 minutes when Jeff Fahey is trying to, when he's in a session with one of his patients, and he's like, "So you killed that your cellmate? How do you feel about that?" And the guy's like, "I feel good, man. I feel real good." And I'm like, "Fuck, this movie's real dark. Yeah, it's going to go to dark places."
And it really
It really sets the tone. Becca,
yeah,
what's up?
I just
this is the most I've ever disagreed with you.
I know. And I mean, if I had to even pick, like, there's other films around this time that came out, like Unborn, I enjoy more than this one.
That's great.
What is it
that, I mean, like,
when the
I'm
head
just very
shows
curious,
up,
just when the, it's
as
too
soon
over
as
the top.
The head shows up, I'm like, wait, I have questions.
So it's a little too so I would say maybe it's like too outlandish for like what
it's
was
too outlandish.
Like
the reveal
scenario.
Was kind of silly for me. Yeah. I know. And then the moment where the head is wandering through and carrying all of his limbs and collapses in anguish while carrying all of his limbs.
That's what I love.
That's one of my favorite horror
images.
So gleefully macabre, you know.
It's just so silly.
That's a good way to put it. Like Grand Guignol-ish.
Grand Guignol-ish.
Who did the effect? In the extra features, he was also talking about somebody who did a lot of the practical body stuff and the animatronic body parts as their other. Anyway, the extras on this are terrific. So if you really dig it, like there's Eric Red, just straight interview telling the story of how it came to be. And there was something else about the origins of it. I just was like, I could get lost in that thing. This would be like if I didn't like Leviathan. It actually hurts. I'm sad. I'm going to have to do a makeup screening.
Well, you don't like Deep Star 6.
I'm not
as into that one either.
I want to ask you about the features because you watched a lot of them.
Some of
them,
yeah.
I've been having a problem with features lately because I used to work on a lot of these. Yeah. And a lot of these recent Scream Factory ones, and it's no disrespect, but I just don't have the patience for really long unedited features. Yeah. And that's kind of what they're doing. Like the Eric Red interview, I always click to see the time. Yep. Eric Red interview is 52 minutes long.
Oh, yeah.
And as soon as I saw that, I was like, I can't. Yeah. I don't have an hour.
I watched like
spent.
20 minutes of it and it was really good.
I miss the good old days of edited documentaries.
Those sound bites need to be curated.
Yeah, they do.
Find the best ones.
Sure. So you just kind of skim through them.
I watched the first 20 minutes of that one and it was really good. And I was like, oh, I'll come back to this. I think, you know, he's telling the story very Beat to beat. Very well. But there was something else on it that was actually pretty good too. And it just totally...
Does he go into anything about...
Oh, the deleted scenes are really good because he talks over them. So that was actually the most useful part.
Does he talk about anything that he was... When he was in post-production on this, he was also writing Lost Boys 2.
Oh, wow.
And it was one of those things where from my understanding, he was juggling post on this, writing Lost Boys 2, which was supposed to be a prequel, which focused on the Lost Boys before they were vampires.
So he's picked because of Near Dark, probably, right?
Huh?
He's probably picked to write that because of Near Dark, I'd say.
Probably. Which was funny because when I had kind of just dug around and I was looking at old interviews with Eric Red about this movie because I was like so fascinated. I wanted to watch the special features, but I wanted to see like in the moment interviews with him. And he confesses that he doesn't like Near Dark.
Yeah. Really?
There was an interview where he was like, the movie did do my script justice at all.
And oh my God.
No, he's not saying that anymore. I wonder if he's still Catherine made this great
over
movie.
This one?
Very interesting. Yeah.
And Hitcher. I mean, and Hitcher is like, Hitcher has a similar kind of pacing. I mean, Hitcher is even more muscular than this. It's like, boom. But Near Dark is too, the way Bigelow directs that. He made this great short you can find on YouTube. We interviewed him way, way back for the first show we did, This Week in Horror. And he, and I don't think he had done much of this stuff because obviously his personal life, you can look it up, had, you know, a lot of dark passages in there.
Yep.
And and so I think he's more of a novelist now. You know, I think he's probably trying to still make films, but 100 Feet, I think, what 100 Feet 100 was feet. The last, which is actually pretty good as well. You know, it's pretty dark vision, I'd say. Like, if you could look through all these films, it's definitely...
Well, they all connect.
Yeah.
All the dots connect.
Yeah, you know, it does, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
but that's
body parts.
You know, yeah,
body parts.
Body parts.
I really
three thumbs up.
The two films down. I most wanted to come out this year were this and Let's Scare Jessica to Death, and they came out on the same day.
Oh man!
And I've watched Let's Scare. They're totally different movies, but this is the one I'm most excited about because I guess. We're doing a body horror episode together in a couple of days.
And we are.
Guess which film I still have to talk about.
If you haven't seen this one, I think this is going to be a huge discovery for a lot of horror fans.
Oh, for sure.
I think they're going to really love it.
I think that I need to reapproach it as not taking it as seriously as I want to because the beginning, it's so
serious.
Yeah. Like, it's this serious setup. And then literally when the head shows up, I'm like, wait, what?
The head is serious. It's a serious head.
You're with the head or you're not.
Yeah, Ryan nailed it. I think it's the tone of a Tales from the Crypt. Yeah. A lot of those start serious.
But it doesn't start like that. But even the Tales from the Crypt, the music will always be a little bit sillier.
Oh, my God. Let's talk about the music of this movie.
It's so heavy-handed, though.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
It's good. It is a good composition. But at the same time, when it gets kind of sillier at the end, I'm like, wait, every other cue I'm being given tells me that this is very serious.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, if I recall reading, this movie had a hard time in the theaters because it was also during the time of like Jeffrey Dahmer's trial, I want to say, or Jeffrey Dahmer was prominent in the news. So like a lot of people were like, body parts don't necessarily need to see that at the moment. I could be completely wrong, but
I know that
that's a better story either way. That's a good story. I like it.
I will always remember this as 1993. So
91.
No, this was 90. I would have been. No, wait.
91, according to the IMDb.
91.
I was young. And, I'm surprised you're on dates. Right, I think I was like
I was with a group, but I remember specifically that I was there with a gentleman named Ryan, and it was like one of my very first boyfriends.
I just like that he's a gentleman. He's like, to me, he's a 30-year-old while you're like 13. This is really creepy. I'm a gentleman with my 13-year-old bride.
Well, I didn't want to go on and be like, and then he dumped me at, you know, the sixth grade. We were there with like a group of people, but it is one of the very first movies I remember holding hands with somebody in is Body Parts.
Well, Becca and Ryan.
There you go. Hashtag for all you at home.
Hashtag Becca and Ryan.
I don't know when I saw the film because all I remember is the trailer for you. But look up the trailer. It's a really fucking good trailer. And like you said, the moment we're kind of talking about where a car pulls up next to another car and something has happened, I'm just going to leave it that.
It made me want to go. That scene in the car made me want to go down a deep dive of other similar scenes and see if I could collect. Maniac the only other Cop one I can 2. Remember is Maniac Cop 2.
Yeah.
And that's like a year before. It's around the same time.
And again, it's when you can do any stunt-wise like you in the streets in New York.
You have helicopters flying through downtown Los Angeles.
If you see two cars running through, if you don't love that moment, I can understand being silly, but you got to love two cars doing that. It's crazy.
Yeah, so good.
Anyway, this movie is badass.
All right. 3/4 approved.
My star inflation on Letterboxd might be a little high, but I'm sticking with it. Like even Brian wrote to me and goes, 4.5. And I said, well, I gave it 4, but that extra scene was awesome.
I'm just going to say, I don't even know if you gave Vertigo that.
Probably not. It's probably, this was probably my highest rated movie now on Letterboxd. So.
Oh, my God. That's amazing.
Well, it's almost Shockwaves approved. It will break my heart. One day I'll convert and move on.
All right. I'll dive in. Yeah, so this is one that I've heard Elric talk about a lot. I've never been able to find it because the DVD is so rare. And it was such a surprise when, for Vinegar Syndrome's Black Friday sale, it was one of their titles.
Yeah.
Because we had heard there were rights issues and all sorts of stuff. I'm talking about the new Blu-ray release for the Candy Snatchers.
Oh, yeah.
I haven't watched the Blu-ray yet either.
This was a hard one to find for years. I remember Elric and I talking about it with Darren Lynn Bousman.
Could be, yeah.
I remember
Tarantino. Do you know his story about that?
No. What's his story?
Bousman comes to L.A. That's actually really funny. It was one of the first stories I learned here when I got here. He comes to L.A. He goes to a Hollywood party. First party, he sees Tarantino. Tarantino comes over to him. He's just like talking. And he's like, yeah, you know, it's like Candy Snatchers. Darren's like, yeah, it's exactly like Candy Snatchers, having not seen Candy Snatchers.
Oh.
And then something happens in the course of the conversation. And then Quentin kind of calls him on it again. It's where he like blanks and realizes he actually hadn't seen the movie. He's like, oh, fuck, Tarantino got me on Candy Snatcher. And then years later, of course, he had to watch it and then like the movie or something like that.
You can't outdo that to Tarantino.
Great, what a great shitty way to start.
So this was 73 or so, and I don't know. I have a lot of mixed feelings about this film.
Yeah,
it's ugly.
It's a real ugly movie.
Yeah, it's very well made. This Blu-ray looks spectacular. They do actually talk to the director on it.
True Blood or whatever. Yeah,
He's on the disc, and he gives a great interview, a nice concise 15-minute interview. It's really about like right off the bat. There's these three, this group of three people. One's sort of a couple. No, I'm sorry. It's a brother and a sister, and then the guy kind of has a thing for the girl, and they kidnap a young girl just coming out of high school and immediately bury her alive, and the goal is to blackmail her dad into robbing the jewelry store that he works at.
They give her a little pipe so she can breathe.
Yeah, they give her a little pipe, so she's not totally buried alive, but it's still like kind of horrific the way they go about it. And from there, it just keeps getting kind of nastier and meaner because, you know, I'm not going to give too much away, but, you know, their plan doesn't exactly work because maybe the dad isn't that nice of a guy.
Well, neither's the daughter regard. Like, everyone in this is horrible.
Well, the daughter that gets kidnapped?
Yeah, I remember
her. She's a complete innocent.
Okay.
I mean, all you meet of her is her leaving.
It's all the characters who like turn on each other. They're all like,
That's all I remember is finishing the movie and being like, everyone was horrible.
Yeah. Like there's one of the guys that's of the kidnapping troop is like really sympathetic and nice to her. And then he does something so horrible to the other female that you're like, oh, all right. Yeah. Nobody's really great. And on top of all of it, the only one that's kind of aware of everything going on is this little mute boy. He's literally like 8 years old running around and he sees like the hole sticking up where she's trying to breathe out of. And he keeps like putting his hand over it to cover it, like cutting over oxygen and stuff. And it's like one of those like slow burn things where you're just like, oh my God, this is not going to end well for anybody, no matter what happens. So, I mean, it was very entertaining and I'm glad I got to see it like a couple of years ago. When it was kind of quote unquote forbidden fruit, when you couldn't find a DVD anymore, it's like, oh, I got to see this movie. Just how fucked up is it? And I can't explain it. Maybe it's just who I am now in life. Like, yeah, I would have liked this 10 years ago. It's just not my kind of movie now. Like, it's very much in the vein of Last House on the Left and maybe I Spit in Your Grave, even though not as gnarly as that, but it's in that dark tone.
Yeah, it's
I'll give
its
you a
time.
Perfect example. After I watched this, like I popped on Shudder, for example, to see what was kind of streaming, and I caught a little piece of Devil's Rejects, which is by far the one movie of Rob Zombie's I actually love, or at least I loved when I saw it. And the scene I was watching was so horrific, like Bill Moseley's amazing, and it's basically when he takes those two guys out into the desert, that I was like, I don't even like ever want to watch this movie again. Mm. Like it's that unpleasant. And that's kind of how I feel about Candy Snatchers, even though I think it's – like if you're into that sort of thing, and I know there's a lot of horror fans that really do want the most fucked up thing they can find, this kind of fits in there. And it's even got a slightly – it's almost like a slightly comedic tone even though it's not.
That's the weird thing that I remember about this. And that's – it. Actually, I remember reading like a lot of controversy about it because it does kind of get – rapey in moments of it. But
it's got a really ugly
rapey. Kind of rapey. It gets rapey. But at the same time, the rest of the film kind of has a much more comedic tone than even things like Last House.
It's famous for that goofy image where they're all wearing the Groucho Marx glasses, which is a great image. Like,
it's like the opening shot, I think.
And this one has a really bleak ending, if I'm remembering correctly, where like nothing gets resolved and it just kind of...
Well, let's not give away the ending, but yes, it's pretty dark all the way through, right to the bitter end.
Yeah. And
emphasis on bitter.
Yeah. And it just kind of fizzles out at the end instead of resolving anything. But that's it is. It's comedic. And that's the weird thing is kind of how horrible everyone is becomes the source of the comedy, which makes it more difficult to watch.
It's got that folky like score that feels like what David Hess did on Last House. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like where it's like this dark thing that's got like this beautiful folk music almost playing through it. But I don't know. It was interesting. And I was glad we finally got to see it. I'm glad there's this version available of it. And, you know, it's interesting because I keep in touch with all the Vinegar Syndrome guys. And, you know, that was one they thought was going to be huge. And it's not at all. Mm. Like Spooky's was the big surprise, as well as Tammy and T-Rex for Black Friday.
Spooky's but is not. I mean, that to me makes
sense.
Right
now, everyone's asleep on Candy Snatchers. And so if that, you know, if Last House on the Left and things of that ilk are your bag, you should definitely pick this up from Vinegar Syndrome.
I think, I mean, also it's a very big surprise that they traced the rights, because I saw this on 35 in New Zealand at a film festival, and that it was such a great way to discover it because I'd never heard of it, and it was at Aunt Timpson's thing, future guest in a couple weeks, Aunt Timpson, and then me and him basically decided, hey, we can remake Candy Snatchers, but like set in an LA Hollywood producer story, like not make it as rapey and ugly, and he literally did some work, and then he came back and he said, this film will never the legal rights on this movie are so ugly and so like maybe the worst of any film he had ever looked up, and then so I just thought, okay, that's never, and then they put this movie out, so maybe for distribution it's a little cleaner because no one's going to come after you.
I think all the producers and people are
gone.
That's the sense I got from the interview with the director,
but it's a great title, and it's a really cool concept of a kidnapping movie. It's got that alone has enough, you know, to make it kind of an interesting story. But yeah, I can't really fully endorse it without rewatching it because it's been a long time. But I did love seeing it that way. And then also when we're younger, I think you're right. I was probably 21 when I saw that. And you are excited to see something new no matter how extreme. Yeah. And the older you get, no matter what, even the most liberal person, you get more conservative, just not conservative in your politics, but conservative in just how you feel about stepping out of the door and safety. Totally. And so it does affect you a bit.
Yeah, I can see that. I've completely fallen asleep on this movie. I've heard about it. I've read about it. But hearing you guys talk about it, I want to check it out.
We should borrow it from us first and then see what, you know, if it's worth buying.
Yeah. Candy Snatchers.
I took a dip into 1993. Right. We're all early 90s.
What happened in 93?
Necronomicon came out.
Hey, now. Ooh, yeah.
Now,
did you go see the Book of the Dead screening?
No.
He got the Diabolic DVD. Got a import.
It was an import. Oh, nice. It was a German import. Not necessarily steelbook, but it was like a beautifully bound case. Like
they screened it at Egyptian two weeks ago.
That was Josh Miller and his crew. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They showed it while this Blu-ray came out.
While I was watching it. Yeah. Nice. That's just how the cookie crumbles, I guess. I would have loved to have seen it on the big screen. Yeah.
I love this
one. You know, when this movie came out. You know, there was like a lot of fanfare that was surrounding it because it was a combination of Brian Usna, all of these makeup effects maestros, Christoph Gans, who never really had a name then, but not until
before Brotherhood.
Way before Brotherhood of the Wolf came out. Shizuki Kaneko, who people had known.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, Usna tackling H.P. Lovecraft without Stuart Gordon this time.
And Jeff Combs.
And Jeff Combs playing Lovecraft himself. And in this film, Lovecraft is this... Lovecraft is heading to a library that is kind of is shrouded in secrecy. There's monks all around, and Combs pulls a little devious move on the monks and finds his way into a wing of the library that he's not supposed to be in, and enters a room he's not supposed to be in, and opens a door that he's not supposed to open, and he discovers the Necronomicon hiding behind. Strangely, hiding on the second floor of a room, and he drops the key into a grate, but the grate has water in it, but he's on the second floor. Yeah. I don't know. There's all sorts of very, very weird logistical things. Becca's watching YouTube.
Sorry.
You can't open those ads, Becca.
I can't open an ad. mad.
But basically what happens is once Lovecraft gets to Necronomicon, he opens it up and he starts taking notes and he starts actually writing stories. The first one being The Drowned by Gans, The Cold by Kaneko, and Whispers by Brian Usna. And then Usna also directed all the wraparounds. That's really funny because I remember the first time I saw this film, I was like, meh, didn't live up to the hype. This is kind of cheesy and kind of tacky, and the makeup on Combs is really bad. And I it was a younger horror fan who was throwing a lot of shade on a film that kind of sends me warm feelings now. I think that it's a three-part anthology. And they're all pretty consistent. I think the weakest one is Whispers.
Mm-hmm. What's the weirdest?
It's also the weirdest.
Cool. The cold one is pretty freaking awesome. The ending with David Warner.
I love that one.
So you got are fucking bonkers.
Yeah. So you have notable actors. You got Combs. You got Bruce Payne. You got Richard Lynch. You got David Warner. And the first one's like pure Lovecraft story. Yeah.
It's actually one of the better Lovecraft just stories.
Yeah. It's about love lost and love regained through things spells and things from the sea. Tentacled monsters, yeah. And then you've got Bruce Payne being a hero and kind of swashbuckling at times, like grabbing onto a chandelier and swinging his way across a giant room while a tentacled monster tries to reach out to him from below. The Cold is a kind of a quieter story, more contained. And then Whispers is a contemporary story about two cops, and one they're chasing this thing. There's this guy named the Butcher, and they get into a terrible car accident, and the Butcher grabs this female cop's partner. She goes chasing after him and discovers this hellish underworld beneath the big city. But rewatching it, I just kind of respect its ambition and its scope, attempt at scope. Even if it's not entirely, like a lot, the kind of high caliber things we love. I really enjoyed it this time around. I'm glad I owned it. It was like probably the third time I've revisited it, after a long, long time. I hadn't seen this movie in a while.
It's a big deal that it's coming to Blu. I think that's awesome.
It took forever. This was a huge thing where it had been trapped on VHS for so long.
You see it at
long.
These bootleg sellers.
Yeah. And it looks good. I mean, there's some, if you have, it's a region free disc.
Yeah. It's tough to get. The one that you got though is already sold out.
Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah. It was
I posted it and a bunch of people tweeted or messaged.
It's a limited edition. It's sold out from the company that did it. I forget the name of them, but
Wild something or Wild Release.
Yeah,
or
but you can go on Diabolik DVD, and one of the great features they have is even though it says sold out, there's a join wait list.
Yeah.
And literally just put your email in, and when they get more in stock, which they tend to always do.
They do, yeah.
They'll always somehow get – you'll immediately get an email with a link straight to it. So I'm on that wait list because I did not jump on this.
You know what wait list I'm on? It's the Dr. Giggles Blu-ray.
Yeah.
That I missed
because Jesse over at Diabolik, he tweeted something. He's like – just got
one
this,
copy. Yeah.
I got this one Blu-ray copy of Dr. Giggles import region whatever. Yeah. Get it while you can. And I'm like, I was literally driving. I pull over and I'm opening Diabolik and I'm like, yes, it's there. I add it to my cart. I go to put in my credit card. He's like, sorry, this is sold out. I was like, no. No.
I love that Ryan pulls to the side of the road to buy a Dr. Giggles.
I tried. I fucking tried. Don't even ask me why.
Account on file. You would have been good.
That's a 90s medical technology horror film that I fucking love. Dr. Giggles?
It's fun, but it's nowhere near.
Oh, it's so good. It's wonderful.
No, it is. I know. I have supreme respect for Dr. Giggles. But Necronomicon, if you can find it, check it out, especially all you Lovecraft lovers out there. It was great because Ciara has been plowing through all of Lovecraft's books on audiobook. And she's like, it's 500 hours of pure Lovecraft. But
I like the way he looks. I mean, because they make him look very thin in the face and weird nose. I mean, because Combs looks nothing like him.
Yeah, yeah. He's got the chin. He kind of – it's like Jeffrey –
Bruce Campbell.
It's almost like – yes. It's like you're slapping Bruce Campbell's mug on Jeffrey Combs and this is what you get.
Perfect.
It's the perfect love child of Bruce Campbell and Jeffrey Combs.
I would like that one
Oh, my God. Fans would line up around the block for that child.
Yeah. I've heard that. No, I wish – Necronomicon would make a good show now. Like you could put that as a series
with
that kind of style and that kind of effects.
Well, this was also the time when Usna was being – it was kind of he was paving his own way in the producing realm, and he was getting money from Japanese financiers. He was basically producing movies from whomever in the world was willing to give him money. If it was coming from Spain, Japan,
Spain. And there's quite a few bad ones right around there. And I think when that came out, I just wrote it off when it first came out. I was like, oh, I don't even need to see that now. Right. It wasn't until years later I saw it.
Yeah, I remember he had this one, and then there was another one that he did that was – it was an underwater one about a town that had been sunken, and it was through Spanish financing.
Faust, a Faust tale.
Well, that was more early 2000s. Yeah.
No, but they often had – like all those films, they often had good effects. They just didn't always work dramatically.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I like this one a lot. It's just a fun array of stories.
It is, yeah. Becca?
Okay, so I have been doing Giallo January on Nightmare University.
So jealous.
So I have been watching a ton of Giallo films, which I know that Elric has watched most of as well, because we did screen drafts this week and argued, we drafted our top seven Giallo films, like the seven best Giallo films that have ever been made. So please listen to that episode.
Successfully.
Yeah. Yes.
No blood was shed. It was actually pretty, I actually will say I really like the list.
We each drafted,
I've been on that show a number of times and never liked usually don't like the list afterwards. That one, I was like,
yeah,
I
really liked what we came up with. And I vetoed one of his and he vetoed one of mine.
No spoilers.
No, what? That's not a spoiler. And but at the end of the day, but I have to say that kind of my biggest, like, holy crap, I had forgotten about this and loved it. There were two of them. So I did watch Fulci's Psychic, which was not one. I remembered this one, but I was excited to rewatch it because it is like Fulci doing Hitchcock. But you talked about this one as like your number one discovery of last year.
Yeah, I'd seen it on VHS, but just in terms of their restoration and just the way it kind of, I reevaluated how kind of a classy, for Fulci, a film it was. I was really just kind of surprised.
And so then I follow, and yeah, that one is totally, totally classy for a Fulci. I followed it up with Lizard in a Woman's Skin.
I have this, but I am very afraid to watch it.
Oh, it is so fucking bonkers. It is about a kind of, well, like most Giallo films, she's wealthy. She lives a very privileged lifestyle. She is... lives next door in this nice apartment building, but she lives next door to a woman who they refer to as a hippie, but it's a very European understanding of a hippie. So I'll say she's kind of bohemian, but mostly she just does acid and has orgies. It's like, it's a little bit different from our understanding of a hippie here. But yeah, so bohemian woman lives next door, has crazy parties, orgies, and does a lot of acid. One night, as she is falling asleep to the sounds of the crazy acid-fueled orgy next door, our protagonist has this crazy dream where she dreams that she is involved in a murder of this woman. And there's these weird scenes on a subway where naked orgy havers are like grabbing at her body. And
I don't know if that's the technical orgy term haver. For somebody in orgy.
Orgy havers.
Orgy havers.
I love it. I love
orgy
it.
Orgy havers.
No, that's great.
Orgy participants are like groping her. All of the orgy colleagues are having, they're like groping at her. And then it leads into this crazy love scene where she ends up dying. And then she wakes up and somebody actually killed her. And so she becomes kind of convinced that, like, I must have done it. I dreamed I did it. And then some of the people that she dreams about, she begins seeing in her real life. And then other people start dying and she becomes kind of mentally unhinged. It's all very trippy. A lot of people in it are on acid. There's even one girl that the police are interviewing and she's like, I had so much acid. Acid was flowing through my toes all the way up to my head. It was just, there's a lot of acid, but it's very, very trippy.
Did I read somewhere that there is a really nasty dog death or
so
dog
that,
experimental?
Okay.
Thing
so that,
happens,
yes, there is that scene. So, and it's completely just wedged in as like horrifying nightmare moments. So there is a scene.
She's at
the hospital questioning her own sanity and her doctor's there going, no, you're hysterical, but you're not insane and you didn't kill the woman and everything's fine and don't even think twice about it. Your husband's, you know, going to take you home because man. And she is running through the hospital and she just throws open one door and it's like an experiment where all these dogs are kind of like sawed in half, but they're still alive and they're hooked up to all these machines.
Oh.
And then the doctor comes in and he's like, oh, you found my experiment. Don't look at that. And he closes the door. But after she's been staring at it for 30 seconds and what was really kind of it's horrifying at the time, you know, they're kind of wiggling and writhing around. Supposedly, when I was researching the film, That scene, people were so horrified by it that they actually thought that it was like real dogs that they had done this to. And Fulci was supposedly like brought up on animal cruelty charges for the movie.
That's right.
And had to go to court and bring Carlo Rambaldi, who did the dog effect, say like, no, they were totally just like puppet dogs.
That's the story I had read.
Yeah. And so it's a scene that's not connected to the film for the most part.
I got to be honest, it's what kept me away because I read about that. And then I read about all of the I don't know. I just felt like it was like a Cannibal Holocaust situation where I was like,
no.
Okay, and do I really need to see this?
I had heard that story going in. So I was expecting these real looking dogs. And then as soon as I saw it, it's the standard it's totally giallo orange poster paint blood. Like it does not look real. Yeah. But
I'll check it out.
So it's just basically a bonkers film. So, and then the other one that I revisited was The Fifth Chord, from 1971 by Luigi Bozzoni. And Elric and I have both said this. I cannot tell you what this movie is about. And I saw it like 3 days ago. What I can tell you, it is the most beautiful Giallo film ever. Yeah. Like cinematography-wise, I can remember so many shots. I have no goddamn clue what the plot line was. It was very standard Giallo, whatever
it
was.
Same cinematographer as Apocalypse Now, so... You know, there's that.
Yeah. And so
it's pretty good.
It's 100% like style over substance because the Giallo film, I was with it. Like I could follow the plot while I was watching it. But like literally Elric and I, when we were having conversations about these 48 hours later, I was like in Fifth Chord. Wait, what was that one
like
about?
20 minutes after it ended, I forgot. That's what prompted the tweet. I was like, you forget these plots 30 because I literally was like, I just watched this. Why were people
being
killed?
Marathoning these.
Oh,
no,
yeah.
It was weird. But this
being
one
able to remember anything.
This one also has Franco Nero. And so Franco Nero, you can watch him do anything.
I can remember scenes with him. I can remember setups. But this is, it's a very geometric film.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
And it was really fascinating because right at the same time I was watching this, I had that morning, actually, I had watched a documentary on Netflix on how we as humans perceive beauty. And the whole documentary focused on how we, without realizing it, perceive beauty in geometric patterns, like the idea of symmetry, of looking at someone's face and symmetry, or you know, having squares lined up, or the rule of thirds on screen. And then learning all of this and then watching this film, it was so applicable, like the way that geometrically that everything was formulated on screen. The cinematography was just decadent.
He has a great chart online, Vittorio Storaro, on like what every color that you could possibly imagine translates to emotionally. And it's really cool. I don't necessarily believe it because the problem with color theories like that in cinematography is cultures. Every color, red is a different in Western culture than it is in Chinese culture.
Right.
But it is really interesting. And so you see that this is somebody who is almost – he is scientific in his approach to light and shape, to how it moves you. And I think that is pretty awesome. You know, and when it works, it connects. But yeah, this one's a great looking film. I watched the thing I was just going to mention quickly, because we talk about all these a lot in depth on that show. But I did watch both the Giallo documentaries. I hadn't seen either yet. Mm-hmm. So I watched Yellow Fever, The Rise of Giallo, and I watched All the Colors of Giallo.
Yeah.
So the difference, I watched All the Colors first. Some really good interviews in that. But it, again, like what you're just saying, it feels a little... like it feels more like a longer extra feature with some really good interviews, but not necessarily the shape of a documentary.
Yeah.
And the other film feels more like the shape of a documentary. And the only qualm I have with that is then it just kind of goes towards Dario and just stays on Dario and never comes back. And it kind of – it was a bummer. It's definitely the better of the two, but it never tells me about J&B and never tells me why these ended. You know, it's like I wanted that part of the story, if you know what I mean, just to get that full picture. But the only other one I'd mention quickly, because I don't think it's a Giallo, it didn't make my Giallo list and I hadn't seen this one before, is All the Colors of the Dark, which got that blue ray. And it's a really cool little Satanist film. Like it's really not a Giallo at all because the guy's not masked. He's this guy with bright blue eyes following her everywhere she goes, and you can't tell if he's real or some haunting creep. And she keeps seeing that she basically gets lulled into the satanic Edvig Fenich, who's utterly beautiful from all these Martino films.
Yeah.
And she gets lulled into the satanic ritual, and then, you know, you can't escape. So it actually feels much more like Rosemary's Baby-ish. Even though it has like a lot of the hallmarks of Giallo, it never really feels like this. So I did not count this as Giallo, and I really enjoyed it. It was a fun movie. But it was fun. I got to say, I was a backup. I got pulled into this. So I watched all these movies. But the reason I said yes, and I know you couldn't believe it, but the reason was I have all these beautiful Blu-rays sitting on my shelf. still in plastic wrap, and I'm never going to get to them unless there's a theme. And so as soon as I was like, you know what? I want to watch 5G Alleys this weekend.
Yeah.
And you know, and it gave me a reason to do it.
I had a problem with them, and I gave them shit all week. Because I see the stack, and I'm like, how do you have time to watch
them? I wasn't
going to
watch
stack?
Them all. I was deciding between them, and it's not the size that counts.
Wow.
Of your shallow stack.
Wow.
It's the width.
Wow.
All right. Fair enough.
But it was fun. It was a fun episode. So if people want to sideline to some giallo, it's over there.
Yeah.
Nice.
Cool. Ryan, did you have anything else?
Freaked.
Oh my God. You went to the freak screening. Yeah,
guys, I mean, this is the Freaked is one of those films that was the perfect misfit movie for a nerdy little horror kid growing up in Connecticut.
Poster up in my bedroom.
What's
when
that?
I was a kid. I had the Freaked poster up in my
bedroom. Oh, God,
so
man.
I remember at my local video store, they used to put all the posters that they got that they weren't going to put up in the store. They'd put them out in a bin for free. And I got Freaked and Cast a Deadly Spell.
Mm-hmm.
And I had both of them up in my bedroom. So.
This movie, I mean, like, it is a... It's a cattle call for the nerds and the misfits and the weirdos. Alex Winter from Bill and Ted and Tom Stern co-directed the film together. And it is just an amazing cast. It's like Brooke Shields and Bill Sadler and Winter and Randy Quaid and Mr. T, Keanu Reeves playing the dog boy. And basically the movie is about this child star turned douchebag older actor who gets enlisted by EES, Everything Except Shoes, as a corporation that wants him to fly to South America to basically be the poster boy for this terrible toxic waste company. And much to the chagrin of all his advisors, who when we first meet him, he's like surrounded by like a bodybuilder, a fortune teller, and then a bunch of other weirdos. And he's like, should I do it? And he all looks and they all go, mm-mm. And they're all shaking their heads. And he goes, all right, I'm in. And before you know it, you're right. He's on a plane. He's flying to South America. And what he discovers is while en route to the corporation in South America, he takes a little side journey to Randy Quaid's freak show exhibit with one of his
best
friends.
Already a bad sign. Randy Quaid's
Randy Quaid show exhibit.
Freaks. Remember what he does to his daughter.
In South America.
Best friend. Daddy's the best French kisser.
And what Ricky Coogan, who is Alex Winter character, what he discovers is that Randy Quaid is in South America using the toxic waste that he's supposed to be promoting to create freaks for his attraction. So you've got the bearded lady. You've got Bobcat Goldthwait playing a tourist who's got a sock head for a sock hand for a head. There's a cowboy.
That's his appeal.
That's his thing. That's his freak. Yeah. Well, the great thing is they go into these like backstories of each freak. Each freak sits around a campfire and explains how they became who they were. And they do like the kind of like watery dissolve to the past. And you see Bobcat Goldthwait. He's like, yeah, I went to this freak show. And Randy Quaid's like, hey, how you doing? And Bobcat's like, good. And then all of a sudden they cut to him just turning into the freak. And they come back. He's like, I'm not so good at stories. And so everybody else got this. Everybody else has this elaborate story. He's just like, nah, that's it. That's all I got. But the one that drives me to tears, I mean, you're kind of getting a sense of what kind of humor this movie is. There's a moment where while they're doing their backstories, they cut to a hammer laying on the ground. And they do the watery dissolve to the past. And they cut to a hardware store. And there's a wrench hanging on the wall. And Randy Quaid walks up and he goes, grabs the wrench, puts it in the paper bag, brings it back to his freak machine, turns the wrench into a hammer. That's why he's a freak. And there's just some really weird, goofy shit. I mean, this so Mondo, Death Waltz, and Beyond Fast, these fucking maniacs out here. They put on a 35mm screening. Phil Blankenship, who is a print collector out here,
and on Pure Cinema pretty regularly.
And on Pure Cinema,
every calendar episode.
Yeah. And he lent this team his 35mm screening. They did a print at the Egyptian Theater. Death Waltz and Mondo put out a record release, and then everybody was there. It was insane. I mean, like no Keanu, no Mr. T. But I mean, they
I've
had
seen
at
Keanu
least,
before there.
Yeah, so. They had like 15 to 20 people up on stage doing a Q&A. The great thing too is before the film, during the introduction, they said that they were going to have a hologram Henry Rollins. The Henry Rollins was sitting behind me.
Yeah.
But they said they were going to have a hologram Henry Rollins.
The Henry Rollins.
The Henry Rollins.
The real Henry Rollins?
The real, real Henry Rollins was behind me, but they were going to use a hologram Henry Rollins to put on a performance during the Freaked title sequence, which is fucking amazing. It's just like this animated sequence of claymation and all this other kind of weird shit. But
they were going to Tupac that?
What they did is they put a screen alongside the Egyptian theater screen and projected kind of a cutout Henry Rollins from back in his youth. He was just like basically wearing shorts. And it was amazing. It was amazing to see. They just basically hit play on their Mac, and it was just like this animated Henry Rollins dancing around. It was very weird. It was very Beyond Fest.
Yeah.
But Freaked is one of those films that kind of fucking hard to find. I mean, like when I was in high school, I picked it up immediately on VHS, and then Anchor Bay did this wonderful special edition that I unfortunately lost to a relationship, but. I think it's out of print. You have to go to eBay to pick it up, and hopefully some savior will come out of the woodwork and re-release this movie because it holds up. I mean, it really brought the house down. There were people in tears. It is the weirdest fucking thing.
And the effects are really good.
The effects are so good. It was like Screaming Mad George, Tony Gardner, Steve Johnson. It was like all of these heavy hitters at the time coming together to bring this menagerie of freaks to life. God, I'm trying to think. Who else is in this? There's one other person I'm blanking on. John Hawkes.
Oh,
wow.
John Hawkes was there too. John Hawkes plays the cowboy who is literally a cow boy who wears a cowboy hat. Nice. Anyways, Freaked. Yeah. You have to check it out. It is amazing. Every time I try to explain it to people, I wind up just like internally laughing a lot.
Yeah. I'm more amused than body parts. Yeah. Oh, I know. Elric just rolled his eyes so hard they practically fell out of his head.
We're friends.
It's
okay. I know. Freaking's going to end over body parts.
It's going to end over body parts. It's something, hasn't it? Yeah, I think that's probably a good one.
Oh, well, I'm just going to really quick. A couple of months ago, Scream Factory had put out a box set of all the Fly movies.
Oh, man. I've
skimmed a little bit of it. Like, there's a great brand new interview with Mel Brooks on the Cronenberg one. And just hearing him talk about the Fly is just incredible.
How he connects to both Lynch and
Cronenberg. Oh, yeah, totally. Like, okay. So anyway, last night I decided, you know what? It's time to go back to the beginning and go through this whole set. So I watched the original 1958, The Fly, which... I mean, again, they always cite this as the quintessential remake, like how to remake a movie. Mm-hmm. But I rather like this original movie a lot. Vincent Price is great in it. It's got this whole like science gone wrong, quirky vibe to it. It's in full color, even though the sequel after this is in black and white, I guess to save money. Mm. But yeah, I mean, it's basically a scientist that creates this thing that takes matter apart and then reassembles it. And much like in the movie that you probably know, he gets into – you don't even see it. It happens off screen. But he gets into it one day and a fly gets stuck in there as well. And so they're chasing a fly with a white head because they assume that the only way to cure him is if they can get the DNA that he shared. and of course, like his little son found it and let it go. So it's like this whole like thing throughout the whole thing trying to find this fly. And then him, obviously, he's got a hand and a head that's covered to hide what's happening to him. And it's still to this day one of my favorite reveals of all time when his wife just pulls that thing off and it like zooms in and his little like mouth is moving and then you cut to his POV and you see his wife like, you know, like 100. Yeah, it's wonderful.
So fun.
But it's great. So this set is great. It looks great. And what's he showing us?
Wait,
that's why we didn't recognize John Hawkes.
I'm showing you John Hawkes.
John Hawkes.
Oh my God.
Wow.
He's a cowboy.
You had to be there, listeners.
I'm sure.
I'll put it up on our Twitter.
But yeah, this set is great. There's like an hour long documentary on Vincent Price just on this first disc and tons of special features. And I love the second one, so I'm going to go right into it. I don't think I've ever seen the third, Curse of the Fly, which apparently has nothing to do with The Fly, apparently is a pretty cool horror sci-fi movie. So just a shout out to Scream Factory for First The Omen and now The Fly.
Yeah.
Great
nice.
Set.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. Great set. Yeah. So there you have it.
This weekend, Elric and I will be at Panic Fest in Kansas City, and you can join us. We are doing a live show on Sunday morning where we are looking at our favorite body horrors that are not Cronenberg.
But yeah, well, the curveball is we will start by discussing Cronenberg, but then we're going to pick films that are non-Cronenberg.
Yes.
Yeah, that's the plan. I haven't picked anything yet. I'm way behind.
And totally on brand. I mailed him my
except
picks.
The body parts, which is going to have to at least be an image. I'm not talking about that.
I did my homework already, so yeah.
Okay.
All right, so be it.
All right. Well, we have a very special guest waiting on the other side of these sponsors. Yeah. Fright Rags is celebrating the 30th anniversary of Tim Burton's classic Edward Scissorhands with an all-new collection. Available now, get Edward Scissorhands apparel featuring shirts, socks, and an enamel pin. Also, keep your eyes peeled for Fright Rags' second Vestron collection featuring shirts from Waxwork, Blood Diner, and my personal favorite, the Wishmaster. You'll find these available Friday, January 24th. Shop now at fright-rags.com. Again, for shirts from Waxwork, Blood Diner, and Wishmaster, Shockwaves listeners get 10% off their first order using Shock2020 at checkout. Again, 10% off when you check out at fright-rags.com. Use the code Shock2020.
This week's episode of Shockwaves is sponsored by RLJE Films. Richard Stanley returns as the director of Color Out of Space, starring Nicolas Cage. See it on the big screen today. Head to colorout of space.com and find a theater near you.
From visionary director Osgood Perkins and an executive producer of The Insidious comes Gretel and Hansel. Forget the fairy tale that you know and witness a dark and twisted adaptation of the beloved story. Sophia Lillis of It stars in Gretel and Hansel in theaters nationwide on January 31st. Very excited for Osgood's new movie. Visit GretelandHanselTheMovie.com for more info.
It's 2020 and Fangoria magazine is back on shelves, and Fangoria.com is on a mission to bring you even more horror content than ever before. It's a great new decade to be a horror fan. Fangoria.com is your destination for all the horror news of the day, featuring a constant curation of the Fango editorial team's favorite links from across the internet. You'll also find deep dives and daily thoughts from the biggest names in horror, as well as exclusive access to the Fangoria Vault, which we've been into and it was highly impressive. Become a Fangoria Plus member and receive your coffee table worthy issue of the magazine, full digital access to Fangoria.com, invitations to special events and screenings, and much, much more. Go to Fangoria.com and become a member today. Use promo code Shockwaves for 15% off right now.
Okay, we're back, and earlier today, I took to social media and I asked all of you listeners out there. Oh, yeah, Elric. I asked all of you listeners out there, which horror film are you looking forward to seeing the most in 2020?
Ah.
Yes, the results were varied, which was very nice. We got some, and Elric, you'll appreciate this. We got a few Come to Daddies.
Oh, hey. Yeah, that's a good movie. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I cannot wait to watch that one. And
sure. Like, it's kind of horror, but like also kind of weird thriller thing, you know?
Well, that's how I kind of felt about, St. Maud.
Okay, I wanted that one to be on my list.
Yeah, that one's high on my list.
I saw a few St. Mauds on there, and I just want to say, just manage expectations in terms of how much horror you're going to get. I think the film is excellent and very good.
Copy
it's a slow
that.
Burn, but just you know, the trailer is very scary.
Yes, the trailer. The trailer has sold me.
Yeah. You know what's funny? A lot of folks were chiming in saying that the James Wan giallo. Now I haven't been paying too much attention to Malignant, which is the new James Wan film. Has he been saying in the press that it's a giallo?
No. But what's weird,
somebody else
said that Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright are doing a giallo.
So that's what I hear. Yeah, okay, interesting.
So maybe they could have just gone that name wrong.
I saw it a couple times. Antlers, we've got Antlers color out of a lot of color out of space.
Yeah.
A lot of Invisible Man, which is very nice to see. A lot of Halloween Kills, which is also very nice to see.
Candyman for me,
cool.
Baby.
Yeah, man.
I'm very excited.
Well, that's the thing. I think that a lot of people forget that Candyman is coming out later this year with Jordan Peele producing. Another one that we haven't actually talked about, the trailer dropped over the holiday break. called Antebellum.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Which looks like the Jordan Peele film. It looked reminded me.
It's not. It's the producer from Get Out, but yeah, I'm not even sure which one it is.
I haven't even heard of it in the trailer.
I'm intrigued. Completely off my radar.
Yeah, because
I saw the trailer and I was like, oh, shit.
The trailer does not give plot indicators. We're just getting these kind of glimpses of visuals. So all I can really tell is that it goes back and forth from Civil War, it looks like, to contemporary
with the same character.
Well, what's really interesting is that trailer also kind of reminded me of the Twilight Zone, the first entry in the Twilight Zone, the movie with Vic Morrow, where he plays the racist who is being bounced through different racially heightened times.
Such a smart idea when you think about it, like, you know. So it's kind of a perfect concept for that kind of Twilight Zone.
Yeah, no, really, really good. And what else we have? We have a lot of Gretel and Hansel, which will be out next week.
I mean, just because Oz, it's always curious.
And also, those trailers, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah,
and especially for a big movie, you're like, what? Yeah, that's so one.
That is one that I am so excited that he got that made, just because that would be something that I would say would be a really hard pitch, because it's period piece, it's based off a fairy tale, and kid protagonists. And right there, those are three things that'll knock you down off of big budget movies. So the fact that he was able to get this made, it just makes me giddy.
It has Alice Krieg. Board Queen.
Ben Wheatley's Rebecca remake for Netflix?
Wait, what?
Yes.
You know about that?
That's wild, right?
I will watch Ben Wheatley do anything but Rebecca.
Wow. You know, he's British at least, so he's got that going for him.
Yeah. Conjuring 3, there's also Terrifier 2, someone reminded me is coming out. The Lodge, which it comes out next month. But it shows Antlers.
Do you guys have one? Like, is there something? I mean,
I'm very intrigued by Antlers. I love Nick Antosca.
Yeah.
You know, Nick came from the Channel Zero team and
Scott Cooper directed it, maybe?
Friend of the show, yeah.
So it's always fun to see that non-horror director who comes over and makes something that looks like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're like, okay, I'm in.
Yeah.
Mine was Underwater, which I fucking loved.
Lived up to expectations,
completely. Yeah. Man, I wish that was doing better at the box office. Yeah. Go see Underwater while it's still in theater, if it's still there. But yeah, so that was like my big one. I'm also intrigued by Fantasy Island. I mean, that's just in a couple of weekends, right? So
today's episode is brought to you by Blumhouse
and Fangoria
and Fangoria and Nick and
Rob, what about you? What are you looking forward
to? Well, I didn't even know about this, but Japanese filmmaker Sion Sono.
Yes.
Oh my God, I love anything he does.
Well, he's got a new movie called Prisoners of the Ghostland with Nicolas Cage.
What?
Mm-hmm. And I just happened to talk to one of the other co-stars.
That is just going to be the most fucked up thing ever.
And our mutual friend Bill Moseley.
Bill Moseley.
Because he told me he just got back from working with him in Japan and Nick Cage.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's cool.
Yeah.
Wait, what's it called?
That's a fascinating.
Prisoners of the Ghostland.
Oh my God.
Well, and also, I pointed out to Becca before, they also snuck at the very end of the year a brand new film of his, Forest of Love, onto Netflix with no fanfare, and it's brand new, made for Netflix.
I swear that dude makes
it.
And you're like,
have you seen it yet? No, is it bonkers?
It looked great.
I mean, it's him, so I assume
just like,
it's bonkers.
He's a pretty major. So that's the weird thing about Netflix.
I got to add it. Yeah, because you know what? Somebody on the group, and I'm drawing a blank, Paco Plaza has a new movie that's on Netflix now, too.
What's that?
What's it called?
Not Veronica.
No, not Veronica. Hold on. Let me find that really
quick.
Okay,
so while Rob's looking that up, the Edgar Wright movie is called Last Night in Soho.
Yeah, which you hear has got giallo vibes, whether it's giallo.
Yeah. And then there are a couple others that I was reminded of, thanks to you guys out there. Benson and Moorhead, Synchronic.
Yes. Oh, it's phenomenal.
I can't wait.
Yeah,
it's
more sci-fi.
It's not horror. And I will say it's definitely got this kind of racial overtones to it where it's time travel, but it's kind of posited and looking at kind of our racist history
within it.
It's really, really smartly done. I had a blast with it.
The only movie I'm most looking forward to, I don't even know if it'll come out this year, but it's meant to, is Under the Skin. Director Jonathan Glazer makes movie every 8 years, and he's got a new movie. I think it's set in a Holocaust, and that's all he's told anyone. Whatever it is, I've loved all three of his films, and over the last 20 years he's made three films, and I've loved every single one of them. Sexy Beast, that, and Birth. So I can't wait to see what he'll do.
Okay, so this is the problem with Netflix, is there's so many great movies that you don't even hear about. So The Forest of Love, I just added, that's the one we just mentioned, and Paco Plaza made a movie called Eye for an Eye, and it just got added a month ago.
Okay,
so it's on my queue. Eye for an Eye from Paco Plaza. I have no idea. It's just maybe it's
so
a revenge movie
weird.
But it's the director of Wreck, so of course I'm gonna check it out.
So weird. All right, well, Let's segue to a release that we all, I think we're as Shockwaves approved because it made our top 10 of last year list.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did you know this?
Popped up on Shudder.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't think I'd seen it by the time that.
I think I saw it after. Yeah, because I saw it. I got an early screening of
it. Well, let's talk. Yeah. Let's identify the movie. The film is The Headhunter. If you have not seen it, it is a keyhole look into a fantastical world, very contained, has scope on such a low budget, deeply engrossing. And behind that film is a man named Jordan Downey. Jordan, thanks for coming on.
Thank you guys, really, for having me.
Yeah.
And I did know that you guys did include it, you know, high up on your best of the year list. I didn't listen to the episode yet, but somebody did point it out to me. And I remember hearing when it first came out. However, one of you guys saw it.
Maybe it was Becca. My manager sent me a link and he was like, it was kind of making the rounds at the time. And this is before it came out, like months before. And he was like, this is so your jam. And I actually watched it at studio school where I teach with Elric on like my office hours. Because I remember you walking in, me being like, shh, I'm watching this. Go away. This is great. Yeah, and I was just completely spellbound, mesmerized by it, wanted to know how it was done.
But through all of that, let me just give one more little piece of introductory table setting is that you had also given us two films that I did not know when you and I met generally. I had no idea you were behind Thanksgiving and Thanksgiving 3.
That's both of them. Gobble, gobble.
And what happened to two? Who did two?
We skipped part two.
We skipped part two.
Genius. There is no two.
Table setting done. Yeah. You guys launch into it. But no, seriously, I mean, like, if you look at an independent director's career path, going from Thanksgiving to Thanksgiving 3 to The Headhunter, which is just a drastic tonal turn.
Oh, yeah.
And a different command of your craft. Very unusual, man.
I mean, it's kind of weird for me to say, but like, because I love the Thanksgiving movies. I grew up, you know, loving going to the horror aisle and renting all of the schlocky, the trauma stuff, the full moon stuff. I love the holiday classics like Jack Frost and Leprechaun and all of those. Mm-hmm. So we made that, you know, as kind of a love letter to that cult, you know, campy sort of genre. But I always was the Headhunter guy, you know, like it was weird making those because I can go back and watch them now and it sort of is an odd out of body experience where it doesn't feel like I was there as much as it was like kind of us trying to be other people or, you know, contribute in that way. But yeah, totally. I get it. Totally different. And there were a few short films in between that then kind of helped me recalibrate a little bit. But no
directors have ever done that before. Bad taste, Lord of the Rings.
I know.
You know? So, I mean, you're in good company. Him and Sam Raimi, you are fine.
There's not many. Yeah. Peter Jackson, probably the best example.
I mean, that's Meet the Feebles to, you know, Heavenly Creature. It's wild.
I know. Well, it's funny.
That's the same human, you know?
Yeah. And Meet the Feebles, I was forbid from renting as a kid. That was like a huge thing.
Why that one?
Because it was X-rated, right? I think the VHS release.
Wow.
And there was some little stamp or decal on it that said something about puppet sex or nudity. Yeah.
My parents just did not give two shits what the hell I did. Oh, my God.
I have this book of like old movie tickets that my brother kept sort of like a journal entry of like tickets that our parents would take us to. And I was going to like Alien 3 in theaters and stuff when I was 4 or 5 years old. So they were taking me, but then for some reason they'd get on this one or two movies that I was not allowed to see. So maybe the Peter Jackson in the Thanksgiving trajectory is because I was banned.
Well, I look at it as a James Gunn trajectory as well. James Gunn came straight out of the trauma roots, you know, over Romeo and Juliet and all these other kind of, you know, button pushing, you know, scandalous films that I was not allowed to be watching the Turk household as well. But meanwhile, over in Becca's world,
I totally watched Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah. That's nice.
Well, I mean, so the thing that struck me about it is usually when I hear, the budget first, and then I hear about the film, it's like sometimes, okay, I'll watch it.
Yeah.
Because you have a certain expectation. What's so interesting and kind of the part that dumbfounded me watching it is in terms of the aesthetic. I see the choices. You're being very careful what parts of a world you show. And that's where the intelligence of it, but also it does feel like a big world. It's limited to like mostly one character, but it never feels cheap, not at all. Like it feels like quite a big scale in terms of just pure visuals of the film. And so I guess I'm just completely curious how you pull this off, or how you approach, if you wrote it as something to just get made, mm-hmm. like for whatever price you could get, or if you knew what you had and had to write, you know, and I'm just curious because it doesn't feel compromised in that way. It feels like everything's a very clear choice and well thought out.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I mean, so the origin of it basically is twofold. One, our mindset, which was just go make a feature film. And that was different than the Thanksgiving movies. And that was just built up from years of submitting things and meeting and writing specs and all that kind of stuff, and then having a hard time getting stuff going. And so we kind of just sat down, Kevin Stewart and I, who I wrote it with, and we'd done the Thanksgiving and collaborate on everything together. With that mindset, just sat down and said, okay, what do we have? And Kevin is from Portugal. His dad's American, but his mom's Portuguese. Mm. And his grandma lives out in this village where only, I think there's literally less than 5 people that live there to this day. So the cabin, the hut location in the Headhunter, was this little old grain mill that sat on the property that his grandma owned. And he showed me a picture of this. So we had the location, but we weren't thinking medieval because that just did seem too expensive. But the Thanksgivings were super cheap, and the shorts that we had done were always super cheap. I was always sort of this DIY kind of guy, and I was, you know, wearing many hats, and I did special effects makeup growing up and in school. And so kind of all of those like difficult elements weren't really scary for us to start to include in any kind of ideas we were having. So we kind of reverse engineered the movie for the location. We didn't say the movie ended up costing $30,000, but we didn't say, okay, we have 30 grand. We just figured, okay, let's just put something together. We thought it was going to be 10 grand, to be honest, to start out with.
Had you seen anything recently that triggered you to know that you guys could do that at that scale? Like, no. We were joking about the Jeremy Gardner reference to your lead actor in terms of here, but
because he really looks like Jeremy Gardner.
He really does.
I've heard that. I haven't seen The Battery, okay, but I've heard it.
But that's the kind of film model where it still looks bigger than 7 or 8 grand, of course. Yeah. Like, it feels much bigger, but you can understand the choices to the budget.
Right.
This one, that's the thing. It's the aesthetic that doesn't feel limited.
Yeah.
I don't see you cutting corners. Besides how much you show, say, monsters, of course.
To be honest, most everything I wanted to be in there that Kevin and I wanted to put in the script is in the movie. The final monster fight, maybe we would have done that in a little bit more of an elaborate fashion. But for the most part, everything's in there. Once we had the idea, then we just sort of started the funny story of like where pre-production began. And I can go on and on about all of the ways that we were able to pull it off for that budget. Was we went to the Spirit Halloween store the day after, because on a Critters short I had done before that, I did the same thing where I bought up a bunch of materials there to build the bounty hunter's costume. And 2 days after, you guys know, it goes like 75% off of all the props and on all the masks and everything. So we went, and the very first sort of – in the past, every project I've done has always started with like once I start to spend a little bit of money, then it's like now it's official. That's like us giving ourselves the green light, I guess. So we went to Spirit and bought up every plastic sword and helmet and mask and monster and anything that felt medieval or gothic, chains and bear traps, all that stuff. Bought it all up and just threw it in storage and knew that, okay, cool, we have the groundwork for what we can then start to age and modify and rip up or – to sort of take a mold from or whatever we were going to do. So that's kind of where that was where it began. Once we made this purchase before we had a finished script.
But when did the medieval idea part come?
Well, we were just sitting down and kind of throwing out ideas and talking about what could happen at this village. And you look at the village, the photo, and you wouldn't do something that feels too contemporary there. So we immediately started throwing out ideas, and one of us, I don't know where it came from exactly, but we just had the idea, the scene in the movie when he kind of first comes into his hut and he kicks the door open and he puts the black tar on for the first time. We had that idea for a scene, and this was going to be the opening scene of the movie. This big badass warrior dressed in armor and leather sort of riding over this misty landscape in a Viking kind of Lord of the Rings sort of setting. And he was going to have a sack on his hip, and it was going to be bouncing. And as horror fans, we know what's probably in a burlap sack. And that when he kicked down the door and got into his house, then he's going to reveal that he has this massive wound and a giant claw mark through his armor. And the sack was going to get tossed off to the side, and he was going to put this black potion then in his wounds. So we started sort of just spitballing this scene out. Mm-hmm. And then once we had that, then we kind of thought, well, what if that black healing agent could get on the sack and what would be inside of that? And then what if that came back alive and started kind of body hopping? So the medieval thing, we didn't set out to say, hey, let's go make a medieval thing. And I mean, I love the medieval genre, but I wasn't like thinking in the back of my mind, oh, I got to go and make one of these of my own. So it just simply came out of it was the best idea we had at the time.
But then you also have to get excited and put some legs, put the emotion behind it. So like his backstory for what he's trying to do. And then like even just starting with all these heads instantly intrigues you because you're like, oh, what are they? Why is he collecting them?
Yeah.
You know, what is the story here?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I mean, it's just really smart, economical, give us enough crumbs to buy in early into the film.
Totally.
Yeah. So then you had to pack up everything and take it to Portugal to film?
Yeah, yeah. We had these four giant black duffel bags because we did all of the prop making. I mean, there was no prop maker. There was no production designer or effects team on the film. Besides, we did outsource the main monster head. We had a guy we'd worked with build that. But the rest we did ourselves just in our apartment doing this process called corpsing, which probably a lot of listeners have heard of or seen. But you see it in like Halloween mazes and stuff. But you basically take like plastic drop cloth and wrap it over something. So if you had a skeleton, put a drop cloth over it and then you hit it with a heat gun and it sort of shrink wraps that plastic, but it gives it all these veins and textures and you paint that and it starts to look decayed. So we did that in our apartment and just had mask and head after head after head, not knowing really how they were going to go or where they'd be organized, but just that we couldn't have enough heads and gory props and swords and anything that felt, you know, authentic to that time period.
And that was a very smart move because since it is such a simplistic movie plot-wise and location, the idea that you do have this incredible production design once you enter the cabin, it becomes really captivating to look at.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
How long did once you landed in Portugal, what were the next steps? I mean, like looking at the, you know, production design, all of that stuff. I mean, like think of it as, there are independent filmmakers out there that want to glean as much info from someone like you that pulled off scope and ambition on such a small budget. Once you land in Portugal, what's the next step?
Then what? Well, okay, so we get to Portugal and we go to this remote village where you have to go about an hour to get to a sort of a hardware store or restaurants or anything like that. So we're really out there.
And are you staying out there? I mean, like, are you guys are hunkering down at night?
Yep.
You're sleeping
at Kevin's grandma's.
At Kevin's grandma's house.
Zero permits.
No hotels. No permits.
In Portugal.
No, I don't speak Portuguese, so I barely could interact with a lot of the locals. Kevin does, obviously, and there were a lot of his family.
How did you find the main actor, your Jeremy Gardner?
Is he from like Norway or somewhere? Like
Rye? Did he say his last name?
Rieg. Yeah, exactly.
Because I look as he did your movie, and now according to the ever reliable IMDb, he's like the go to medieval guy because everything since
Viking beard.
Has been some sort of Viking or medieval character. So I feel like you set him on his way.
Well, he has that look, the hair and the beard, kind of force him to be thought of as the Viking guy, you know, and that's certainly how when we saw his headshot, we thought of him for. But yeah, I mean, how we found him, you know, obviously, if you're going to try and make a virtually silent film that's going to all rest on one guy's shoulders, he's got to be really good. So it was Kevin who found him from just literally a Google search because we figured we're not going to find an American actor. We're not going to do a fake, you know, wig and beard or anything like that. So let's try and start our search out of London or somewhere in the UK at least so that there is an English accent and that it feels a little bit more authentic. And I think Kevin found some old casting website and just kind of plugged in like Nordic as the drop down search feature. And Chris was one of the first photos that popped up. And he told us later he was like literally weeks away from canceling his account on this site because it hadn't led to anything. So we just saw his photo and he had never starred in anything. He'd been in some music videos and short films. But I just had a good feeling about him, just his eyes. There was something, you know, in the videos that you could see that he had talent and
absolutely
blew us away.
And is he staying at grandma's house as well?
Yeah. So we're all, so we get to Portugal.
Amazing.
With our four duffel bags that I built a note because I was worried TSA was going to freak out.
This guy's got a lot of sores.
Yeah.
and
bodies. It's the little girl's body, that like chupacabra thing corpse. It looked horrible on an X-ray, I'm sure. So I made all these notes that said these are theatrical stage props, and everything was like zip tied to all of these bags and all of our contact info, because we stopped somewhere, you know, in London or something along the way. So I was just worried that these are our hero props. These are one of a kind. Like, if they don't get through, like, we're screwed. When
there's
get there.
No Spirit Town in Portugal. Yeah.
No, there's nothing.
No Halloween store.
Nothing. We didn't have our supplies. So the four duffels come back or come through. Okay. We get to this village. It's me and Kevin get there first. We're there, I believe, 2 weeks, maybe 3 or 4 weeks, but I think it was 2 weeks before Chris arrived. Mm-hmm. So we had 2 to 3 weeks to prep the hut location and finish up some of the props we couldn't finish in LA before Chris came. And the day he came, we started shooting. There was no time because he had to be out. He had like a month to be there, basically all of the month of March. So we just start going through the village under Kevin's grandma's house and in some of the other villages that are mostly abandoned. She had all of these old rusted pieces of metal, and some of it was like an old coffee grinder that he uses in the movie. A lot of weird trinkets and things that we would find just hidden in this, like, you know, cobblestone pit, basically, that were, you know, they weren't actually medieval props and tools, but they felt old to the eye. They felt medieval. So we were able to basically, for every one piece of plastic from Spirit, we kind of had a matching metal thing that, or some sort of a prop that looks really good that would have been really expensive to rent or age if you were doing it in LA.
Visually, it was like the optics are, it's grounding the fake props that you
exactly
have.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Wow. So we start with production design. You know, I didn't have a chance. I do like to storyboard and shot list as much as possible, but we spent so much time on the production design, like just that hut location, the roof, were those orange Spanish tiles that sort of slide off. So we had to cover that. And we were like, okay, well, what do we have around? And there was a giant field of grass. So Kevin and I get out there and just start cutting the weeds down and start trimming all the grass and then throwing it up onto the roof so that we could, you know, cover up all the Spanish tiles with the grass and then putting wood to, like, hold it all down. And all the whole time that we're doing this, we're like burning a bonfire because we're trying to make it look like his fire pit has sort of been lived in, and we're stomping the mud around his place so it doesn't look normally you'd want to like preserve that stuff on a set, right? But in this case, it needed to look muddy and lived in and broken down and worn out. So production design, that was where it was. And it was just every little skill that we had learned. You know, all of the furniture in that place was built. And the biggest thing about this, and on a low budget thing, it, like I was saying, if you're trying to do this in an office or something contemporary where you needed a sci-fi tech angle, like, that's going to be so much harder than when the furniture in his place is built out of wood. I would just go out and chop a tree down or something and find an old board and hammer it together, and it barely would stay put on set, but it could look, because this guy was living out of the woods and he was building his own furniture, so it could look homemade to the character.
And how long did this process take?
3 weeks about of every day, 12 hours down there. Well, sunrise to sundown, as long as we had. Yeah. And then at night, we were doing little bits of scouting for some of the other locations, but we kept it all very close. But most all of our time went into the production design and art department stuff. And also, the costume we had not seen in person. That was made in Sweden by a guy named Andre, and he shipped it to us in Portugal. It had been fitted on Chris, so we knew it would fit, but we hadn't actually seen it, and the leather was kind of stiff, so we kind of had to break it in a little bit. And then the hero prop, the monster head, we had seen that, but we still hadn't kind of figured out how it was going to really work or puppeteer and some of the, like, spinal cord kind of stuff. So it was all art department and special effects that we were doing, which was kind of frustrating for me because I didn't, in the end, get to really storyboard or shot list anything. I was basically doing it the night before. Every night we'd shoot, I'd shot list, wake up the next morning, do a little bit, we'd go and shoot.
Now, how big was your crew? I mean, you obviously had, like, a DP with you. Kevin. You have, like, that was Kevin. Okay, so there were two of you. Did you guys have any other crew?
We did. So we had, but... So basically, Kevin and I were there early doing all this art department stuff. And then Ricky, who we went to school with and were friends with, who was the producer on the film, he flew out and helped us with everything. I mean, he's the credited producer, but he was also doing a million other things, from holding puppets and in production design as well, because he's pretty good with his hands. So Ricky was there, and then for 1 week of shooting, we shot for 4 weeks. 1 week we had another friend that was coming out because he wanted to sort of do a European vacation with his wife. So he kind of came and helped us for a week, or he was there for 1 week. So there was basically an overlap where we had four crew members, including myself.
You're spoiled.
But most times it was three, me, Kevin, and Ricky, and then Chris, the actor.
Now, assuming that you were using natural lighting the entire time, obviously, like, how did you, like, what did you shoot on? Can you talk a little bit about kind of the cinematography prep for it?
Yeah. So we were going to rent the camera from Chad, this friend that came out and helped us for a week. He was going to bring it out from LA, but then we ended up finding in Porto, which was the bigger city close to where we were shooting. There was a camera and G&E house there that we could rent some supplies from. And we got just as good of a deal, basically. So we rented the camera there. And Kevin had a small lens package, maybe two or three. Mostly we used the zoom lens because I wanted those, like, sort of hand-cranked, you know, 70s-looking zooms for the look of the movie anyways. So we kind of mostly shot it all on about one lens, depending on what we needed. So a small camera package. And we had a mic, just a shotgun, no sound team. So we had a shotgun mic just on the camera for reference audio, which ended up, we used a lot of that stuff that were specific to some of the props and like the window banging and things like that. And then he had a Joker, a small HMI light, and a China ball, and that would kind of give a sort of a warmer fire glow. And then a lot of torch and fire lighting. That was most of it, which, you know, the sensor on the camera was good enough. It was shot digital, obviously, but it was good enough that we could light with fire a lot of times. So we really pushed it to the limit. But in part of that prep time too, like you were asking about, Ryan, we also had to figure out this torch situation. And there's not very much information if you look online how to make a torch for a movie. So trying to figure out which fuel would burn better and brighter. And we ended up going with this, I think it was kerosene that ended up being best, that would burn the brightest and last the longest. So we had to prep, you know, we had 20 torches going because it would only give you 2 minutes or something, and then you had to swap it. There's actually a few times where in the middle of a take, the camera comes over here and we swap a torch out of frame and it comes back and it's got a new torch.
So all those movies where they're carrying around a torch for like a half an hour and it's like burning bright the whole time, those are bullshit.
That's bullshit. Yeah.
Well, okay, that's medieval fuel.
Right.
Wow. Well, what are some other, you know, film hacks that you had to adopt? You know, like the torch swapping, you know, what other kind of like fun things did you have to do?
I mean, all the effects are all practical. So there's a lot of fishing line in the movie to get the sack to sort of wiggle, or to get the tail in the tunnel scene at the end to sort of spin around and look, you know, like it's, or just shooting it in reverse at times and pulling it off and then flipping that in post. I'm trying to think of some other,
I would say directorially, because it surprises me that you didn't have time to storyboard, because it feels very storyboarded. But off-screen space, I think the ability to your sound design, you know, especially when we get to creature stuff, like to create a bigger world than what we're seeing in the frame is really a big way to up your budget, because, you know, you can do that in post.
Yeah.
You know? But how much of that was going through your mind as you're constructing it?
A lot. I mean, especially things where we would shoot, you know, we knew we were not going to have – there's a lot of – cutaways where then some monster action happens, or that the sound is telling you something's happening, which, to be fair, there's probably one too many for even my liking that we, you know, had to push it as far as we could. But a ton of that stuff. I mean, there, we were always very, very aware of like, okay, cool. We're going to bounce back with the shot now and go to a wide shot or something. And we're just going to hear what's going on in there.
What were you most now that you know the movie's know the movie's good, in the moment when you're in Portugal with three people shooting a film with a Nordic dude, as you're just approaching that on a day-to-day basis, like going through your head, what is the one thing you felt like least confident might not work? Like, but faking it anyway, you know?
Well, like, I mean, actual, like an effect
just
or
anything
a prop
that you were worried about, like
you were like,
that you didn't
know
think was
going to
necessarily,
can we pull this off?
when you get back to America, what's not going to,
I think some of the guys thought like Kevin and Ricky would be, you know, highly critical in a good way, you know, that's what they're there for, but highly critical of the heads on the wall. And like when we'd go in for a close up of like, there's this kind of Yeti Wampa looking monster, this snow beast that its head drops down. And They were like, that does not hold up. The eyeball, the pupil, it's, and I was coming more from like, they love horror films, but not to the degree that I do. And I was like, nah, there's something charming about that. Like, you know, very, you can feel the texture of the thing, and, yeah, and horror fans will embrace that. You feel that it's a practical effect, even if it's not perfect.
Yeah. The men in suit effect. We love it.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's true.
Exactly. So I always knew that, like, what they sometimes thought looked maybe cheap, I actually thought looked really cool.
But you felt like as you were getting, you could tell like, oh yeah, his performance is really great. Like, this guy's bringing it, and I'm getting,
yeah,
I'm getting the core, the heart of this movie is we're getting it.
Yeah, and exactly. We're spending all this time talking about props and art department, yeah, but that was like the number one concern is Chris and, yeah, the emotional stuff, because I don't know, I grew up, as much as I love horror films, a lot of them are kind of devoid of heart and emotion. Mm-hmm. I'm always looking for like, if we're going to kill someone off, can we please care about them first? Where's that moment that, you know, brings tears to your eyes in a film you wouldn't expect? So that's always on our mind. And then thinking about, yeah, when he does go to the grave, that this doesn't come across as cheesy, mm-hmm, but that the performance says that there's world building to the props and production design, but there's also world building to his emotional history with whoever's buried there.
Yeah.
And well, actually, you know, performance wise and just suspense wise, the thing that actually worried me the most going into it is that if we're going to make this movie where his costume and everything was kind of modeled after, let's make him sort of look like Leatherface in a way, there are faces stitched into the cape, mm-hmm, and armor and stuff. And I was just worried that, okay, if we have the protagonist that's almost Jason Voorhees, like, mm-hmm, in an unstoppable badass Viking with all this armor, how are we ever going to be afraid for this guy when he gets in danger? How are we going to give him some kind of a monster that's a head in a sack that sort of threatens that? So that was my biggest concern, is like, can this, if I was like, I don't know, is can we make this scary? Mm-hmm.
But that's your backstory. Your backstory gives him a chink in the armor. The loss of a loved one gives him, there's a point to needle him with.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. That was the solution, yeah, then. Yeah. Just focus really on making him human.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things, too, that I admire is that you bring this seasoned actor, Chris, down to over to Portugal for your production, which is very small.
Yep.
Very minimal cast. And it seems like he just stepped up,
yeah,
and understood exactly what you guys were going for. You know, some other actors would probably look at it and go, oh my God, this is like
three dudes.
What am I doing out here?
What am I doing out here? I'm staying at fucking grandma's house.
And was it snow? It looked cold.
It was.
Okay.
The seasons changed. So we got some snow. We got a little bit of spring. We got rain. We got a little more snow. It was very cold the whole time. And yeah, and I was usually the one putting Chris in the costume,
yeah,
which was a 30-minute process every day.
Well, what were these initial conversations that you had with him? I mean, like, you obviously have to have an actor help trust your vision and trust what you're doing, mm-hmm, on such minimal means. Like, what were you telling him? What were those initial meetings like?
Well, I showed him some stuff that, you know, like some of my favorite suit performances, RoboCop, Boba Fett. I showed him some stuff from both of those movies. And like, for instance, in OCP, in the Dick Jones room, when RoboCop is sort of like on the fritz,
yeah,
before he fights Ed 209, he's kind of very exaggerated in his movements. Yeah. But I showed that to Chris and talked so much about how much emotion Peter Weller has in, you know, 3 inches of his mouth, mm-hmm, and that with the body language. So we talked a lot about that for when the helmet is on, because the helmet is on for so much of the movie, especially the third act, that I still wanted people to know that there's somebody who feels something underneath that armor. But helmet off and all the other stuff, the way I approached it and that we talked about Chris is, this guy is, he's past his prime and he's always in pain. Like, this job, every single thing we do, the pacing of the movie is going to be a little slower, yes, but even him getting up off the floor is going to hurt. And I just felt like if we really make the audience feel bad for this guy, that he has this horrible job, this shitty job, and he has this horrible emotional toll that's been taken on his life, that then if we also make all of his joints constantly aching and everything hurts, that we would feel for the guy in a purely visual way without using language. So a lot of it was conversations about just everything hurts. And it's very raw and primal and all that stuff. And yeah, and like you said, he went there. Like some of those shots where the camera comes in on him and his eyes are bulging.
You feel it. Like even this, now that you said, like everything hurts, even him getting up off the floor, yeah. You realize, like I was thinking at the time that it was because he had all that suit on, but everything's labored.
Yes. And it's from a past of however many years the guy has been doing this and giving his life to the kingdom. And there's one of my favorite moments of the movie is when he's out walking on sort of this, the only time where the movie cuts out to show his journey, and he hears this music playing in a castle, and he sort of looks up. And so here's this party, this sort of medieval festival taking place inside the castle, and he's out here cleaning up, you know, the trash collector.
Cleaning up monsters.
Exactly. Yeah. And there was just something that was both like, you know, fun in a monster movie kind of way, but also really heartbreaking that he just does not fit in with those people and he's this lonely guy. And so that was kind of the approach, and all the conversations with Chris were really about that. Yeah. And he picked up on it quick because he has a daughter himself and he's from a very small town in Norway. So he basically grew up in a very isolated community and he has a daughter that then he could, you know, relate to those scenes with.
Yeah. How do you – so walk us through the staging and or just how your approach to knowing that you have a film, you want to have payoff and you have to have a creature effect. Right. You have to have a fight scene. Like how did you – what was the decision on how you're going to show, what you're going to have to create for that? Yeah. How are you going to feel action when you have a three-person crew?
Yeah, I mean that's the thing is that the Headhunter has its art house elements, of course. But, you know, in as much as I love, you know, art house horror films, like I do actually just – I did want it to just be, in a way, a straightforward monster film. That I was like, I want it to deliver. I don't want it to be the monster is his own worst monster, a psychological kind of a thing, which you could imagine that you could have gone this way, that route for this kind of a movie. So it was always important that we were going to give you a monster, we were going to give you a payoff, and that as much as we could, we were going to try and deliver on that. So yeah, trying to figure out like what that final fight was in the script. We always knew that the monster's head was going to be hopping from this little creature that he kept out in his lake pond for potion making. It would take that thing's body, and then it's kind of dog sized, and then similar to the thing, except the thing it's not necessarily upgrading, but that kind of body element, and then it would eventually get the body of the daughter. And that would be this, okay, that would be a really terrifying concept for a horror film, that a man who wants so desperately to have one more moment with his daughter is going to get it in the worst possible way. Yeah. But it's not necessarily him bringing that on himself like Pet Sematary or something. Mm-hmm. It sort of is involuntary, although it's his, you know, own doing from the window and all that stuff. But point being, we did want to deliver. In the script, we didn't have – I think we just kind of wrote something generic because we knew it would be dependent on the location. But we had something about a final fight in a patch of woods or like in some sort of like ivy or something, kind of like Evil Dead, like something with these jaggedy sort of thorny woods. Mm-hmm. Didn't find that. And we're super concerned about this because we wanted to show that this daughter running around and like actually posing a threat to him, because I already said that was our concern is if we have him in open combat in a field with this little bony corpse, even if we gave that thing a weapon, which would probably look silly, what damage could it really do to him? So all of that in mind, I was pretty concerned. We were shooting, you know, 2 weeks in and had no location for this yet. And Kevin's cousin who lived in the village was like, "Hey, I own this water mine." Not a cave, a water mine.
What's a moderate water mine?
Well, so the villagers you basically dig straight into the side of a hill or a small mountain. It's not really a mountain. It was more of a hill until you hit water, and then the water flows out and that irrigates the land. So they had trenches or like little irrigation tunnels and troughs kind of dug so that it could irrigate. So this water mine was basically only the size of a person because you weren't doing anything in there other than chiseling your way further until you hit water. So he showed us this mine, and it was all overgrown with ivy and all kinds of stuff out front. So we had to sort of cut our way in, and I had no idea what was going to be in there. I was so scared that, like, because I was like, well, I guess I'm the director. I got to volunteer to go first. And so I went in. we ended up seeing bats and they came flying out of my face.
How wide is this thing? Because I'm suddenly just like, well, there's a spider the size of the mine and we're done.
Yeah, it was terrifying. Yeah, it was pretty scary. And there's water up to your knees. So then I'm thinking, okay.
Oh my gosh.
Once there's water up there, I'm out. Like weird sea creatures.
Oh, I know. I'm just thinking of something slithering around leeches, or swimming in the water, leeches. Gee. So we went in and cleared out the bats and whatnot, which they just flew out voluntarily. And then, but the mine, what was great about this, it was, you barely, if you walked through it, your shoulders would touch both sides. So you could only go in and out single file. But when we saw it, one, it's an awesome location that you just figure if you're an indie film, the first thing you got to do is really seek out locations that you don't have to touch as much and that will look great. Just, you know, point and shoot as much as possible. And so it looked awesome. It would be claustrophobic. It would be a different, unique location. It kind of had the feeling of a climax. But most importantly, it would force our guy to sort of pare his armor down because he's too big to fit in there. And the monster, the concept for like the main monster was always going to be that why could it get an upper hand on him and some of these other things that like Yeti monster looks like it would have been much bigger and stronger and he defeated that. So why this? And that it would be smarter. It would be an intelligent creature, something that is more psychological. Maybe it could talk. Maybe it had mind control. We didn't end up going to that degree, but that it was going to be intelligent. And so the idea that, okay, this water mine, this thing would know, now that I have the daughter's body, that I can get into his psyche and lure him in here and pull and have him pull down his armor so he can't swing his sword anymore. He has only a little bit of his armor left, and then I can surprise attack or something. So it felt more believable that this is what this monster would guide him towards. But then actually shooting that was a huge pain in the ass because it was
getting the gear.
How do you shoot in there? Like, did you have, like, I assume the water's still there, so somebody standing up to their knees in water or what?
Yeah, Kevin, yeah.
Kevin, no, we only have three people.
No, we were able to drain actually a lot of it out because we started the irrigation process again by chiseling away some of the muck that was built up. So there was, we still had water boots on to go in, but we could only go in and out single file. So if we were shooting Chris going deeper, Chris had to go in first, then the camera, then me, then maybe whoever else if we had to do any puppeteering or anything like that. So it was single file in. And the worst part is we realized that torch, the fumes that it was putting off in there were starting to give off too many fumes. It was filling up, so it became dangerous. We're gagging, and we're like, okay, we got to. So that was kind of then where the idea of like, okay, let's get the torch out as soon as possible. And also because the spark, he like uses his spark thing to create these sparks, and I wanted that to kind of be like the flashbulb photography of Texas Chainsaw.
That's smart,
But medieval style. So then shooting it, yeah, we have to go in single file. There's one light that was just kind of this really funny looking like fishing pole with a little those headlamps that you get that you put the AA, AAA batteries into. Kevin just put like two or three of those headlamps in a little China ball, so it just created a little blue sort of ambient moonlight, it's cave light. It made no sense where it was coming from, but that's pretty much how we shot it. We would just go in, shoot for a while, kind of have this little crew train, come back out, rearrange depending on what needed to happen. And then once we had the monster actually engage with him, then I was puppeteering it. And Chris is like, you know, going full force, like banging my arm into the wall and like really hitting this thing for some of the stabbing stuff. And we just picked off a bunch of shots, you know. I wish that the rest of the movie does feel a little bit more purposeful and like, okay, it's planned. Like, here's our shot and here's how it's going to progress. And there, it's a lot of just picking off shots handheld and just getting what you can get and snippets of that thing because – you didn't want to show too much of the head.
Mm-hmm. So how long were you in Portugal, boots on the ground, for the film?
2 months.
2 months.
Yeah.
And when you returned back to the States, did all those props come back with you, or did they?
Grandma kept them on her wall. No.
Grandma's got a stash in the basement.
Grandma's got all the heads out in the kitchen. It's great.
No, actually, Kevin's parents were super cool about it. They were like, you know, just leave the hut location as is, because we were packing up and we only had 2 days to pack up, and So they said, just leave it up like that and we'll take care of it later. Or maybe you guys, you know, in case you need to come back for pickup shots or reshoots or something. So we kind of left everything there, which was kind of eerie to think about.
So like, this is going to be like the Evil Dead location where people are now going to go try to find it.
Oh, right. Like, well, not anymore.
It'll turn into a whole
new direction. Now it's gone, yeah. Then so we brought back the hero stuff in case we did need to do pickups, which we did end up doing.
Back in Portugal? You had to
We brought Chris out to here, and we shot up in California in Mammoth Lakes out in the woods because it was just easier to bring him to us at that point.
Yeah.
So like the whole opening with the daughter was all shot 6 months later based on our own little test screenings and just realizing.
That's in the snow, right?
Yeah, in the snow. Exactly. So it worked. And there's actually shots throughout the whole movie, a lot of effect stuff of the monster squirming on the ground. There's some shots in the cave that were shot later in Mammoth across the globe that we just spliced right in, the inner cuts between Portugal and California, and you can't tell.
Movie magics.
Yeah. Well, in some parts of the world, this is called Viking Vengeance. So I thought now we can address both the title and also like what happens after you have this movie, you test it with friends.
Yeah.
How do people respond to it? How does it get to Shudder? Where people are talking about it and sharing it.
Yeah, well, I mean, we didn't have a distributor or a sales agent or any of those kind of things that, depending on how a movie, an independent film would be financed, that stuff's already built in or figured out somewhat. But we kind of were going at it with like, just finish the movie and then let's figure out what the best, you know, place is for it and find a home. And it was actually Kevin who shot Unfriended, Dark Web. Mm. He went to South By for the premiere of that.
Oh.
And he got a pass that allowed them to stay for an extra couple of days. And Ricky, our producer, went with him too. I don't know if he went to the Unfriended screening or not. But point being, they went to South By with the intent of like, we had a trailer for it. It was called The Head. That's what we made. We made a movie called The Head. And it was called that in our early teaser trailers and stuff that I cut together. And then they took that to South By and started meeting with just anybody that would, you know, talk, and met some sales agents and some different people there. But the most important person they met and kind of befriended was the head programmer of Sitges in Spain. And so then that programmer kind of reached back out a couple months later, and just one thing led to another. Basically, we got them the screener and they loved it. So then we knew that that was going to be our world premiere, which was great because we knew for genre fans that was a great start. And then so we went there and just started submitting. You know, we didn't have agents or anybody helping us. We were just kind of going in with contacts we had, friends of friends, just anyone we knew that like, hey, we have got a horror movie, you know anyone? And most people said no. Most distributors, you know, turned it down. And then we eventually got it to, I forget exactly how, Vertical Entertainment, who ended up releasing the movie. And then that we were off and running at that point. And then they were the ones that eventually, so that happened right around the premiere. And then it played at a bunch of other festivals for the next 6 to 8 months until we had set a release date. And then Vertical ended up, you know, dealing with Shudder and getting Redbox and Walmart. And it really just grew from there. And so the title changed. So they, one of the things that we had heard was, somebody had mentioned a title change possibility earlier, and we were kind of like, ah, but The Head feels so much like The Witch or the upcoming The Lodge. Like, it's just the thing, the fly. Like, it's a very classic, but it also does feel a little, you know, B, I guess, The Head. I think there was one from the 50s or something.
There was a TV show, a 90s TV show.
Oh, yeah, there
remember
was.
The Head?
Yes, yes. It was MTV or something, I think.
I think it's spun off of Liquid Television.
Okay. There's a movie called Just Head.
Just Head.
not Just Head. The like,
Head. I'm just glad he didn't add.
Oh,
right.
Oh, yeah, The Monkeys. Yeah.
I'm just glad he didn't add, like, ING, like the Conjuring ripoff titles.
Oh,
you
The
know?
Heading.
The Heading.
We're heading.
The Heading.
Yeah, that's a good point.
The Beheading. Well, Elric, you with that?
This is much more like an occupation. Headhunter. He's got a job. He's got purpose. I like
exactly,
that.
Exactly, yeah.
And Viking Vengeance. Who came up with that? Who was the person who...
Kevin and I came up with the final title. Okay, I mean, it's not that genius, right? You added one word to it. But it's funny because when they were sort of like, hey, guys, we should really consider a title change, because the poster that people can see right now, that the VOD poster, the main one, we had designed that. And that was, and it said the head on top of that. And there was just kind of like, you know, there's a little bit of a disconnect, like the head, but we're showing a protagonist, a Viking. So like, where is the connection? And we tried all kinds of stuff, photoshopping a head into his hand. And we have different stills we took on set of him holding a sack. None of it was as simple and clear as just the head hunter with that image of that costume, because that mm-hmm. costume really sells the movie. The guy does more than a sack or something.
Yeah.
And daylight was something that, you know, like putting the poster in more of a brighter setting as opposed to a dark kind of black sort of poster with a red font to just make it a little bit more unique for the genre. So anyways, with all of that in mind, then they were sort of, and we kind of came to terms with, okay, we need to consider a title change. So I went to the library and bought like, or rented every, you know, weird Satanism and gothic and medieval book I could find, trying to find a word like Witcher. Mm-hmm. We didn't watch the or play the Witcher video games or read the books. I haven't seen the show yet either, but point being, like, that I love that title, The Witcher, because it's like, what's a Witcher? It feels like its own world, but you also can kind of imagine exactly what it is. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't come up with anything. We just sat and read through everything over a weekend and nothing stuck, and we were like, you know, just call him the head hunter. It's easy. It's simple.
if that UK British comedy one hadn't done it, Severance would have been a good one too.
Oh yeah,
that was just Severance and all these heads. I could see that, but they took you.
So. Yeah, we had a big list going. Some of them were pretty ridiculous. And Viking Vengeance. Yeah, that's a horrible title, but
but it'll sell units on Redbox. Viking
Yeah, it's
in Germany. Pretty,
yeah, Germany. Yeah.
I made Legacy of Lies in Germany. So
Legacy of Lies. It's crazy, like what they wanted to change, but then it. It's like it came out in Germany after it had already come out here and got a little bit of an audience going. So it was like, well, why would you want to mess with like what people know about? But whatever.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And have you been monitoring? I mean, you know, as a filmmaker who is very passionate about what you do and with this particular film, have you been seeing the feedback? I mean, like it seems pretty unanimous. I mean, people really, really responding to it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't try to read into stuff too much. Yeah. I think Kevin sort of reads a little bit of everything, and he'll relay more things and
just filtering it.
Yeah, a little bit of filtering, but of course you're curious and you can't avoid it. And so I do read little bits of stuff, and yeah, it's been awesome. It's been very humbling to see that this little thing that we did, which to be honest, like going into it, I kind of thought this is so cheap that if it doesn't turn out to be something we're happy with, we'll just throw it away. No one has to see it.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And then to see it sort of catch on is awesome. And I think it just kind of goes to show that people just like stuff that's unique and different, even if it's not perfectly polished. Like it's just something original.
Yeah. And it's found, I mean, like it's found its buzz. I mean, when my dad reaches out and texts me and says, hey, what's this movie about this medieval guy hunting heads? At the time when he did text me about it, I was like, I don't know, man. I haven't seen it yet. I was like, where'd you read about it? He's like, I don't know. I just read about it in the paper somewhere.
Yeah, somebody like, had told you a couple months prior.
But, no, I know, yeah. I know. I just hadn't had a chance to see it. But when it reaches them and it generates some sort of curiosity, I'm like, oh, okay. There's something to this. And it found its way, which is really great. You know, the headhunter found his way.
He did. Yeah.
Home.
No, it's great.
It's our hearts.
The sequel will be. No.
Yeah, I don't know.
No spoilers, Ulrich.
Back to Portugal.
What does that do? Obviously, I mean, especially because obviously the films you made were wildly different types of movies, but you know they share economy of what what you're limited to do. Does that affect what you want to do next in terms of like upping the scale or like a more of an ensemble because you only had one actor more or less? You know, what are the desires for the kind of project you'd want to do next?
Yeah, I mean, talking is good because really, because even between the two shorts that I'd done prior to Headhunter, both of which were one of them was silent and the other one had very limited talking. So, and I do love visual stuff. Like I love Quest for Fire and stuff that's just like, yep, we don't need to, you know, have talking. I'm not an anti-Tarantino. I'm just saying that like, I'm not really the kind of person that's going to like write, you know, amazing monologues and that kind of stuff probably. So, that is definitely a prerequisite, is that there's more than one actor in it. Okay. But no, I really love science fiction, and you guys were talking about body horror earlier. Yeah. I love that stuff, and that's what I really want to get into, is something that has that sort of like technology gone nice. Wrong kind of angle. Mm-hmm. But that didn't come just because, oh, okay, let's get as far away from medieval as possible or anything like that.
But nothing on the horizon just yet. You're still just in the kind of development.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, the Headhunters opened a ton of doors, and I've met a lot of people and have gotten to pitch different things, comic book stuff, just things that come about, or reading scripts, and then just trying to finishing up stuff that I've been writing. We've been talking about what you could do with Headhunter beyond, mm-hmm. you know, the movie. Is there something more there? And do we want to explore that? Because I certainly don't think it's over for the guy. So discussing that, and then just kind of, trying to figure out what it is that I want to go and do. But I mean, as far as the budget scope, of course I want to keep, getting to higher budgets and be making massive studio movies, of course. But I'm also not necessarily afraid of going and doing the handheld, the homemade sort of thing again. If that's, to me, it's just like, what's the story that interests me the most, the movie that I have to see. And then once that invades, okay, then I'll go do that.
Very cool. And you made a movie without permission, which that's the part I appreciate. Because, budget has to be gathered. But at that budget, you can actually just throw it together with a couple people.
Yeah.
And that's pretty rare.
I'm actually giving a lecture at Panic Fest this coming weekend on it, on the DIY don't wait for anybody's permission. Because that's what I found in Hollywood, is people come out here with really good intention. And really good concepts, very talented people, but they wait for what is ultimately the perfect storm of filmmaking of, here is your $5 million and here's your perfect actor and you now have my permission to go make this movie. Mm-hmm. And then I see people just kind of treading water, waiting for that to happen, and it never happens. That's how my first was just like, okay, well, we can cobble together this much. What can we do with this much?
Yeah.
And that I have found is a much better route to actually like start the train moving forward than just continuously treading water, waiting for someone to hand you the millions and give you permission.
Partly that's showing in the people who are making the movies you were talking about, the giant studio movies, that the major shift. And, you know, there was a time where you had to work your way up a certain type of studio system. And now it's the people who make Safety Not Guaranteed, little sci-fi Sundance thing, or Taika Waititi, or these people who are making a small indie. And then literally the next thing is the giant,
the big thing,
machine, which is kind of very, very new way of casting.
Yeah. Well, even still, like we were talking about Synchronic earlier, like Benson, Benson and Moorhead. I mean, they did Resolution and they then entered kind of this point where I feel like we are now, where it's like, okay, we did the little thing. What's next? And then a couple of years later, they got sick of waiting for the next big thing and just decided to do Spring and still something that's kind of small and homespun. So I love that tenacity. I don't fucking care and I don't need anybody's permission and I'm just going to keep doing that because that's what I'm here for. And it's wonderful.
Yeah. When I first, probably got out to LA, I'd spend a lot of time, or in high school even, like just perusing IMDb and really starting to like study filmmakers' careers. And sometimes that can kind of be a little bit of a trap because you start to try and compare yourself, or like, where's your trajectory going to be? Oh, if you start here, then you're going to be the Peter Jackson route or whatever the thing is. And it's like, I've really kind of over the years started to just appreciate, like, just do your own thing, like really be yourself and find your own way. And it happens sooner for some people and differently for others, but you just make what you're happy doing and have fun doing it, because otherwise you're just waiting around for the thing, the maybe, the what if. And it's cliche, but it really is about the journey, I think that a lot of young filmmakers can sort of fall into that, like, well, I should do this by this age, and then this will lead to this, and it's not always the same.
Yeah.
Very
the
true.
Orson problem. It's the 25, you made your Orson Welles movie. Yeah,
right,
exactly.
Right.
And I always find that I'm frustrated when people will come here and they have an amazing script.
Yeah.
And then it's just standing there with that script, holding out, like waiting for someone to knock on your door and be like, do you have a screenplay? And it's this whole idea of just kind of doing it. Just do it. Just do it. Do it yourself. You can, wait tables. I mean, Jeremy like worked at a bar to get the battery made.
Still does.
So yeah, but that whole idea of just do whatever it takes to do what you need to get it done.
Just do it.
Just do it.
On that note of positivity, Jordan, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks, you guys.
And relaying your war stories.
Very, very inspiring.
Do you guys know where Just Do It comes from? Nike? It is related to horror. The guys at Nike had, they're looking for a new marketing campaign and they were stuck. They were listening to a radio thing about the serial killer Gary Gilmore in Utah, who, when he was caught, they said, how are you going to die? And he goes, I want to be killed by firing squad. Hadn't happened in 40 years. They had to but you have that choice. So they're like, I guess we're going to do a firing squad. They picked up the guns and he looked at them and he goes, just do it. And that's where it comes from. And I'm shit you not.
Wow.
Wow.
That's one of those obscure facts I heard once and I couldn't believe.
Listeners, don't forget to rate and review us on Apple iTunes.
For tidbits like that.
And we will see you next week.
Wow.
Thanks, gang.
Fangoria and Blumhouse present Shockwaves. Shockwaves is a member of the Fangoria Podcast Network, hosted and produced by Rob Galuzzo, Elric Kane, Ryan Turek, and Rebecca McKendry. Sound recording, mixing, and editing by Ernie Hurtado. Music by Gregory S. Burkhart. Logo art and design by Aaron Crawford. For Fangoria, Dallas Donier, Phil Nobile Jr., Jessica Safa-Vamare, Brandon Wynardi, Natasha Pacetta, and Rob Galuzzo.